C1 Detroit.
Now.
This is Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the riff at 4WRIF. That's 4974-3. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Hi, Julene.
Peter, how's it going today?
You didn't get a chance to go to any of the Ferndale Blues Festival, did you?
I have been sick literally for 6 days.
I wasn't going to tell anybody.
Well, you are such
a trooper. No, you sound great.
Oh, thank you. I don't feel so hot, but you know what? It's my duty to be here.
It's a little cold. I was thinking the difference in age. I was at a place. I'm wearing like 4 shirts and inside of Dino's. You know, up
I
on
love Fern- that place.
Yeah. And our pals, the Howling Diablos, were playing. They were kicking it. Tino.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Saxophone Johnny and the boys.
They haven't slowed down at all.
And there's like, you know, 22-year-old guys in there wearing T-shirts. I mean, I have a T-shirt and then a thermal top and then a turtleneck and then a sweater.
Well, you're more of a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout at this point.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you see, it'll be freezing cold outside and you'll see some guy in shorts.
Yeah. Then last night, we went up to House Bayou. This is all in Ferndale, people. I know a lot of you, I mean, some of you listening could live like 4,000 miles away, literally, because there's people listening all around the world. If you go to, well, of course, if you've gone there, you know it, and if you live in some other place and you're not listening to it, it doesn't make any difference. But anyway.
WRIF.com.
Yeah. You can go to my website as well. You can stream through Peter Werby, WERBE.com. But let's see. Last night we went to House Bayou, and it's a nice play on word, right? It's B-A-Y-O-U, isn't that right? Bayou. Yeah, House Bayou, and it's got Cajun food.
It's and, delicious.
Yeah. Oh, man, why can't I always...
Albert, shrimp.
Albert Young and the Straight Eights.
You know, it's funny. Someone called me yesterday when I was on the air and told me about that show, and I said, I guarantee you Peter Werby's going to be there.
They are terrific. Yeah, and nice. Someone said, what does it mean, the straight A's? And I said, it's not straight A's like in school. It's straight eight. And they said, what's a straight eight?
It's a card hand.
A what?
A hand in cards.
Well,
there is a,
you'd be having way too many cards if you had a,
I don't know. I don't play cards. Card.
No, it's an engine, an old-fashioned engine.
Oh.
You know, you have V8s, which you have, it's in the shape of a V, the engine, you have four on each side.
I guess. I didn't know that's why it was called that.
Yeah.
I just know that there's some power involved.
Because you used to have straight eights, which would be 8 cylinders in a row.
Excellent.
So it's sort of
my
like
auto
old-fashioned.
Lesson of the night.
Yeah, right. This Saturday at Dino's, it's our pals, the Luddites, absolutely fabulous band. And at the same time, unfortunately, almost across the street at One-Eyed Betty's, our pal Mark Pasman is going to be playing the blues.
Why did you say unfortunately?
Well, I don't know. I got two people I love and two bands I love playing at the same time.
You know, it's a quick walk across the street, Peter.
All right.
You can do it.
Okay, this is a political, social, whatever talk show that you can dial
but
us up.
Oftentimes music is political.
Yes. 248-544-WRIF. Yeah, actually, Albert Young and the Straight Eights did a song called 52 and Unemployed.
Oh, well, that sounds about right for the times.
And if you don't have those letters on your phone, the phone number is?
248-544. Wait, is that right? 9743. Wait, I just can't get used to these new phone numbers.
Yeah, well, about another 6 months.
When you say it for so many years.
Check out our Facebook page and give us a like, facebook.com/nightcall. We'll take your emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And speaking of email, I remember you told me, I was flabbergasted. Whenever I get over 50 emails in my inbox, I start getting anxious. And you have what? How many?
Oh, I have like 35,000.
Well, I guess it's been a long time since I asked you.
You know what? If I could find a way to wipe them all at once.
I got it.
What is it?
Here
get a
you
new
go.
Account?
This is in the New York Times a few days ago.
Really?
Looking for a relief from a flood of email by Nick Bilton. Well, here's what Nick Bilton writes. On December 31st, I had 46,315 unread emails in my inbox.
I don't feel so bad.
On my first day back to work in the new year, I had zero. No, I didn't spend 2 weeks replying to all those messages.
Or deleting them one at a time.
I deleted them all without reading a single one and declared what is known as email bankruptcy.
Oh, well, I need to declare that. But did he say how he did it?
Well, it's right at the top, that little leave it.
But if they only does one page at a time.
Okay.
If someone can tell me how to do it, I have Yahoo for my email, I would so happily just wipe them all out.
Well, Nick Bilton says, for the first time in history, long-distance communication is essentially free. And these letters are nice, but few of us need paper and postage stamps for correspondence. Not many people write. I just rarely ever write letters.
My mother still writes me letters.
Well, Gaia bless her.
I know.
Yeah.
Very cute.
We no longer count the minutes on long-distance telephone calls or worry about the bill. We certainly don't have to travel to communicate with anyone. Email, messaging on social networks, and even text messages on services like iMessages cost nothing more than the device we hold in our hand.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, we are deluged by messages. There is no escape. Email is probably the most invasive form of communication yet devised. I was having lunch or dinner with someone the other night, and they just kept repeatedly, and I actually said...
Texting,
yeah. Sorry, I didn't finish the word. Did I texting? And you know what happened to that guy? You know, it's funny. Well, here, let me finish about at least one thought, huh? And I actually said to them, any chance you could maybe text later? And they said, oh, sorry. There are some people that are putting forth that crazoid ex-cop that shot that guy over texting in the theater as kind of like an anti-tech hero. That is sick.
That is so twisted.
Yeah, this crazy old codger blows away.
He was mad at someone for texting during the movie.
This was in Florida. Yeah, and the guy is texting his babysitter. He's like 42. He's a Gulf War vet.
Shot him in the chest.
Shot him in the chest because he thought his life was in danger.
And the wife was injured. Now the guy, her husband is dead. It's a horrible story.
Yeah.
And for anyone to even include that as an example of anything that's positive whatsoever, it's just wrong.
According to a recent study by the Radicati Group, a technology market research firm, people send, you ready for this, 182 billion emails each day around the world. That adds up to 67 trillion messages
a
year.
Now, how many do you get on a daily basis, would you say, on average?
I don't know, 40?
Yeah, I get about 60.
Yeah. You're more popular than I am. You got all the boys chasing you, too.
Oh, yeah, right.
But, you know, the...
couple girls, too.
Okay. You know what? I thought there was something in here. You know, people increasingly are saying that they would, you know, if email was invented now, no one would use it. They would all be texting and
I see what you're saying. Yeah, but it's still necessary because... I don't know. You have to hook it up to the printer and print things off. There are still some things done in paper form.
Well, also, you know, some people have more than 150 characters or whatever.
Oh, and to, Twitter?
Yeah, right. Or 130, whatever it is. But the other thing is, it would be like if texting came along first.
Okay.
And someone says, I have this incredible invention. You can hear the person's voice.
Oh, like phone calling.
They go, you mean I don't have to tap out what I'm saying word by word by word?
Well, Peter, I have to say, you have kind of come into the texting world.
I have.
I think you've discovered that it's easier to get a hold of me by texting.
Yeah.
And my 78-year-old mother... is now, I mean, hell has frozen over.
She's down with the text?
Marge is texting. Oh, yeah.
Tell her to text me.
I will.
I'll tell some stories about her daughter.
She knows them all anyway, but she's got a crush on you. My mama has always had a crush on you.
Really?
Oh, she's so handsome.
I like older women.
Yeah, I send her pictures just to get her excited.
This, folks, is the first I've heard of this. Now I've forgotten absolutely everything else I was going to say.
Texting, and you were talking about the guy who wiped out his account.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
All right, but one of the things I thought we'd talk about, because we'd like to get you folks involved in calling in, 248-544-WRIF. You know, one of the things you can always stir up a talk show audience with are talk about guns, abortion, drugs.
Do it every week.
Yeah, stuff like that. Well, we don't. So I was...
Kind of.
You know, if you think about what a disaster... You know, this is really preaching to the converted when I'm speaking to the WRIF audience. But when you think about what a disaster, what an absolute disaster drug prohibition has been... How, you know, talking about losing a war.
Yeah, I mean, filling the prisons with nonviolent offenders.
Well, you know, they say, oh, look at the prison industrial complex. It was another one of those mad schemes that created $1 million coming out of the public coffers, which are filled by you and me through our tax dollars, and then distributed to police departments and the DEA and prisons and prison guards and the suppliers of that. And if you think about when you talk about...
And the owners of the prisons.
Yeah.
Let's not forget
the private
them.
Ones, yeah. When you talk ever, like, say, the military industrial complex, which gets anywhere, depending on the way you're counting it, the U.S. war budget, which goes between $500 billion and, I think, more accurately, closer to $1 trillion, it just doesn't go to the arms manufacturers. But it goes, if you think about it, if there is a Raytheon plant in, I don't know, in Georgia, well, people are hired there, essentially, mm-hmm. you know, by you and me here, you know, because our tax dollars. Yeah. But then it's got, and that's the idea of government spending, what they call Keynesian economics, because it has this ripple effect. It's what they call priming the pump, that with most not right-wing economists, but most modern, well-respected economists think that if it wasn't for government spending, that capitalism would essentially collapse, that it doesn't have the capacity to keep regenerating itself and expanding. Hmm. So you need this pump priming. So you'd say, well, hey, you know, maybe we should have this big military-industrial complex and a prison-industrial complex and a drug war-industrial complex. The only thing is, none of those none of them produce anything that is ultimately good for the people of this country or the people of the world. Yeah.
Right.
If we didn't have a war on drugs, if we didn't have a prison industrial complex, if we didn't have a military industrial complex, most of the public debates we have about policy regarding poverty, regarding medical care, all that wouldn't even be there because we would be spending that money on things we need, roads and schools and first responders and whatever.
Yeah, well, and the environment.
Oh,
you know, let's talk about windmills and solar panels.
Yeah, why don't we have a windmill industrial complex?
That sounds great. Sounds wonderful.
We could do that. But, you know, when we look back, you know, it's so peculiar because I don't think there's too many even conservative politicians that would look back on the prohibition against alcohol and say, well, it was a great idea, produced a lot of positive social effects.
Everyone was still drinking.
Yeah, everybody drank.
And I would say maybe even more.
Yeah, they did. Actually, it increased.
That's what I would
think. Women began drinking a lot.
Hey. You know,
hey.
The ladies. Yeah, don't leave the ladies out.
Before Prohibition, it was mostly men going. Didn't we talk about the other week? Men would be in bars drinking whiskey and beer.
Yeah.
And in a lot of bars, they would have, didn't we talk about that? They'd have a urinal right in the bar. So they'd have the bar. Then you'd want to take
a whiskey.
Yeah, okay.
That.
All right.
That's so odd. It's so,
we don't think it's odd.
Us
guys
it's just
don't.
So, the word I want to use? Primitive.
So male.
so man-like.
Yeah. Hold on, I got to take a whiz.
Yeah.
So you just turn around.
I got to drain the lizard.
Oh, God. So weird.
I like that one.
Yeah. All right. And so Prohibition was an incredible disaster. It created these crime syndicates. We all know this story.
Yeah.
So why wasn't, other than a few of the most forward-thinking people, which include a lot of you folks listening to WRIF, knew that that the war on drugs has been probably 30 times worse than alcohol prohibition, that it criminalized millions and millions of citizens that as Detroiter John Sinclair once said, were put in jail for smoking flowers in terms of marijuana. People that wanted to alter their consciousness. Oh, how evil.
And what's amazing is people are still altering away.
Yeah,
to the point where now we are seeing all these changes in drug laws when it comes to marijuana.
Finally.
Did you see the thing about Marlboro? Now, I don't know. Someone can look it up maybe and tell us for sure, but they are going into the cigarette market with marijuana, and it's a green pack, and it's called M-Cigs or something like that.
Should be something, you know.
With Colorado?
Something high, yeah.
Yeah, well, they don't want to get that crazy.
Yeah. Let's see. Here, though, the decades-long war on drugs has failed, and the world's lawmakers need to consider decriminalization, according to influential world leaders that include ex-United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan and the president of Colombia, even, who knows firsthand what drugs have done to that country.
Can you say cocaine?
Yeah. Annan, who is currently chair of the Elders, a group of world leaders, told the Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, "It's been a disaster and has inflicted enormous harm. Drug use is not down. It's time for a different approach. Drugs have destroyed many people, and the wrong government and policies have destroyed many people." This is, talk about world leaders that get it. There's a difference between, says this article on CNBC, there's a difference between full legalization and decriminalization, where substances are still subject to some restrictions of use. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, who made an abortive run, to be sure, for an adjective there. Well, for the Republican presidential nomination, argued against decriminalization. "It's bad public policy for the government to say, here's one more substance that's not good for you that's legal." And so that's what I was wondering. Did he support the prohibition, or would he support the prohibition of cigarettes?
Oh, well, he's about controlling people. So
yeah. Would he support the prohibition of booze? How about fatty foods? How about salty foods?
How about GMOs? No.
No.
Right. That's too big a business.
You know, I don't use ciggies, but I do use, what a weird term, booze, and I use fatty foods, and I use salty foods.
About you?
I'm talking about me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're pretty careful when it comes to your food intake, Peter.
And my alcohol intake, right?
Yes. Yeah. You are Mr. Moderation. Yeah. No question. Okay. Plus, you're lightweight, so it just can't happen.
And I'm your designated driver of station functions.
If I see you go past two, I cut you off.
Yeah, right. Well, never mind. We won't. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I count your drugs. Drugs. Wow. No. Drinks.
My drinks.
Drinks. Anyway.
We experimented years ago. It was a success. We're over it.
Yes. Here's Rick Perry, governor of Texas, says, "Here's one more substance that's not good for you that's legal." Alcohol, how many lives have we seen destroyed by alcohol?
Yeah, whether it be disease or car accidents.
Yeah.
And, how about drunken rages and violence that result from drinking?
Particularly, which leads to child and the abuse of women.
Yeah.
Particularly. Yeah, all over the world. So, we know. I mean, there is no way that particularly marijuana, but even those other drugs. I mean, for one thing, if you're like shooting heroin, it's not like you're going to go abuse somebody. You're just like, whoa.
I have a couple of people through the years who I've known who have used it, and the way they described it is pretty much you puke and pass out. Doesn't that sound like
I want to do that
doesn't
drug.
Doesn't that sound like a good time?
Let's cop. Isn't that what they say?
Is that what they say?
I don't know.
Is it a drop?
That's score.
Like, I don't know.
I don't know.
So old school, Peter.
It is, but it doesn't sound. But in any event, we know that cigarettes still are responsible for about 400,000 deaths a year. The reason the cancer rate is down is because that cigarette smoking has decreased as much as it has.
Well, and I would say that research has, cancer. I remember the first time I saw an advertisement on television for a cancer drug. And this was, now it's all over the place, these prescription meds, television ads. It freaked me out big time because I thought, whoa, this is big business now.
Yeah.
And this is how much cancer rates have increased to the point it's a television ad? Wow.
Hmm. Well, the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, who once had a chance to be president.
Yeah,
but,
I think he's probably done.
He's done. Took the oath of office for a second term and delivered his inaugural address in Trenton a few days ago. During his inaugural address, he called for an end to the drug war and compassion for those suffering from drug addiction.
Now, where did this come from?
Well,
maybe he figures he has nothing to lose, and he's going to start talking about how he really feels.
Maybe he figures that there'll be some young people that will actually vote
for him. You're like, he's cool, man.
Yeah. Well, he is pretty cool for saying that. He's not very cool for blocking up the George Washington Bridge.
Oh, yeah, and people died as a result of it.
He says, we'll end the failed war on drugs that believes that incarceration is the cure of every ill caused by drug abuse. We'll make drug treatment available to as many of our nonviolent offenders as we can, and we'll partner with our citizens to create a society that understands the simple truth. Every life has value, and no life is disposable. This guy is not going to get the support. This will probably kill him with the conservatives more than his other stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep. And then
as far as the rehab, and it should be offered in prison.
Well, all those people should be released.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. And there are a lot of people who just smoke some weed once in a while. And I'm under the opinion that if it's not affecting their lives in a negative manner, they don't need rehab.
No, of course not. If there is a difference between use and abuse. I mean, I use alcohol. I do not abuse alcohol. Yeah. My father abused alcohol, for instance, and he was a recovering alcoholic for the majority of his life, actually. And then, I don't even know if I can. I mean, we're having such a good time. I don't know if I can bring this up.
You have to.
Fox News.
Oh, God.
Another one of these porn stars that they
delivers the news.
That delivers the news to these middle-aged, angry white guys.
Who are just like.
Yeah, right.
Turning him on with her conservative views.
Fox News host Martha McCollum on Monday asserted that the solution to the arrest gap between black and white Americans was for African Americans to smoke less marijuana.
She is so full of it. And you know what? It is.
Yeah.
I mean, just as many white people smoke as black people, wouldn't you say?
I don't have to because, you know, maybe in our experience that's true. But there was a 2013 study that found whites age 18 to 25 consistently use marijuana at a higher rate than African Americans in the same age group. And yet they are arrested and incarcerated 4 to 8 times higher because they are the customers for the prison industrial complex.
Now, wait a minute. Who's the they? Who has a higher rate of
incarceration and arrest? African American.
That's what I, okay.
Yeah.
You had me confused there.
Blacks and whites use drugs at the same rate.
But the blacks are arrested more often.
No surprise. Because they are the acceptable clients for the prison industrial complex. Yeah. Speaking about Fox News, this, I remember a long time ago, but this was in, who's turned out to be my favorite columnist in the New York Times, Charles M. Blow, speaking about drugs. Blow, you know, isn't that a slang they use for cocaine?
Slang,
yeah. Let's see. Farley Dickinson, which is a college, a Fairleigh Dickinson public mind poll, found that people who watched or listened to no news were better informed than those who watched Fox News.
It's true.
Let me say that again, folks. The people who watch no news, and you know, even some of you, most of you, if you're listening to this show, probably listen, whatever, to some news, so you know what we're saying.
Or read it. That's
read
what
it.
I do.
Yeah, makes some sense. The people that don't do this at all, that don't read the newspapers, that don't watch cable news, that don't watch the network news, they were better informed than the people that were regular listeners of Fox News. I mean, that's how
viewers,
bad it is.
Yeah, and because all it is misinformation?
Yeah.
Not disinformation, misinformation.
Was it Mark Twain who said, if you read the news, if you don't read the newspapers, you're uninformed, and if you read them, you're misinformed.
Especially when they're just spewing lies.
Right. According to the report, the largest effect of a news source that of Fox News, all else being equal, someone who watched only Fox News would be expected to answer just 1.04 domestic questions correctly out of 5, a figure which is significantly worse than if they had reported watching no media at all.
I'm surprised they got one right.
Yeah. And, I don't know. I mean, is this easy to guess? I would have guessed this. What the watchers of what network would be the best informed people about current events?
I don't know.
NPR.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's all the libs walking.
I'm mixing TV with radio here because you keep going back and forth.
Right.
So NPR, radio. Yeah.
Are the best informed. Right. And the second best is PBS.
Oh, sure.
Public Broadcasting System.
Yeah.
Now, here's a shocker. The third best and running right on the heels of PBS, Jon Stewart show, The Daily Show.
I love that.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, my wife, as you know, who's very rad.
She sure is.
She is, but she doesn't.
She's a feisty little rad, too.
She does not watch hardly any of this stuff. And sometimes we watch Jon Stewart, and she says, what's so funny about that?
You really? Know,
yeah. Well,
because she gets all the issues. She gets what he's saying.
No, the opposite. It's talking about current events, and she's not up on current events.
Oh, okay.
So you have to go into that knowing a bit of that. So,
right.
And then, oddly enough, MSNBC, which I would have thought the liberal cable news network, which I would have thought people would have done well. Then comes the people that don't watch any of it or listen to any of it, and way at the bottom, that would be Fox.
Oh, it's frightening.
Yeah.
It's frightening, the ratings that they get and the power that they have over people's minds.
I want to get a, it's for people that that want these polemics against reality. They can't stand reality. So all these people on Fox News, give them permission to stay in this bizarre little bubble and gives them rationalization for their racism, their sexism,
their
anti-environmentalism,
thoughts.
For believing that there's no global warming.
Anti-socialism, anti-Muslim sentiment.
Yeah. Oh, you know, actually, I wanted to talk about socialism when we come back. But also, just before we go to our break, I want to go to Bob and Wayne. Hey, Bob, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how are you doing tonight?
We're good, Bob.
Good. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I had a thing happen to me and to my mother, emails and stuff that were coming from Nigeria.
We all get those.
And my brother lives in Colorado, and they say you got to send them money.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and my mother got a thing from Nigeria saying that her car was stolen, and they had possession of it, and she had to call the national police.
Oh, God.
And don't try to pick your car up. Give us some money, and we'll bring it back to you. But her car was in her garage.
Oh, my gosh. That's really scary. They pray. They'll prey on anyone, especially as your mom a little bit older, getting on.
She's 76.
And so that's scary.
You know, Bob, one of the things that I've seen lately is if you get something that says it's from Yahoo and they say your account has been compromised, you have to put in a new password or something like that, and these people are able to capture your account and send emails out to your list, and you've lost it, and can say, hey, this is Jolene, I'm in London.
That happened, a friend of mine.
Lots of friends of mine.
Yeah.
Three, I think, how many of these people, maybe I have dumber
they
friends.
They say, I'm stuck here,
in
I
London,
lost my wallet.
My passport.
I had everything ripped off, and I need help.
Yeah, I need
money.
I need about $2,500 to pay the hotel bill, and I'll get it to you as soon as I get back to Detroit. So
can you imagine how bad people feel if they actually people sent money?
And you know what? I know a couple people that
who did.
For this one woman, two separate friends of hers each sent $500.
Oh no!
And this the woman whose account it was, who was ultimately responsible for it because she stupidly clicked on this link.
Yeah. Well,
she paid him back.
She did.
Yeah.
That's sweet. But you know, I mean. There are a lot of ways to dupe people, especially over the internet. So I understand that things happen.
Yeah. All right, Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate
you
calling.
I'm glad you guys didn't get caught up in that.
Yeah. Listen, we haven't done any Eat the Rich segment in quite a while. They're doing great. Middle class.
Better than ever.
Yeah. And How much would you think they would pay for a single night in a New York hotel?
And we'll also take your phone calls. If you're on hold, just stay right there.
Right. And I think Mr. Announcer will give you the phone number.
I'm not sure.
We'll give it to you when we come back.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you by MetroPCS. Now with MetroPCS, the 29 for all sale, all 4G phones are just $29. No annual contract. The Riff.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Get everything that rocks on your smartphone. Dave and Chuck the Freak, the Rock Girl, the Riff Man Cave, and more. Oh, yeah, you can listen live, too. Download the 101 WRIF app for your iPhone or Android today from the App Store or Google Play Store. Brought to you in part by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Specs Howard's one-year programs in graphic design, broadcast, or digital media arts sharpen your creative edge. Find out more at SpecsHoward.edu or call 248-358-9000.
Did you know that millions of seniors are treated each year for fall-related injuries? If you or someone you love is elderly and living alone, get ready for a toll-free number that could save a life. LifeStation is a medical alert system that provides the security and peace of mind to live a fulfilling and independent life in the comfort of your own home. Call LifeStation now at 1-855-322-5013. For less than a dollar a day, LifeStation offers quick access to medical help at just the touch of a button, 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. And with LifeStation, there's no setup fee and no long-term contracts. You can cancel at any time. Call right now for more information at no obligation. 1-855-322-5013. Put emergency help at your fingertips while maintaining your independence. Call LifeStation at 1-855-322-5013. The call and information are free. 1-855-322-5013. That's 1-855-322-5013.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Our phone number 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
You got that, huh? Caught it right in the middle of a swallow. That was that Jim Beam and Coke?
Oh, yeah, I'm always...
Can't do that here. No, nope, sorry, I shouldn't even joke about that.
It's not... Yeah, don't joke about me cussing or drinking on the air. I don't do... I've never done that.
Jim Beam, by the way, Jim Beam has been bought by a Japanese company, Suntour.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You go to Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and lots of stuff there. I'll even give you a little idea what is... got the wrong stuff here. Let me see. One thing, we have our guest list. Oh, yeah. This has to do with this. My old friend, Michael Stephen Smith, who, along with his wife and another friend, have co-edited this book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And, I start the interview off with saying a lot of people already think we do. Barack Obama, you know, was bringing in Sharia law and socialism and what have you. But anyway, Michael says capitalism has failed and that a program of democratic socialism would solve the nation's problems. And, you know, I predicted on this interview that I'm going to air at 1 a.m. that this book will hit the New York Times bestseller list. He has been getting inquiries from all over the country, including that conservative talk station in Detroit, WJR, Frank Beckman show. That is so...
Why do you give any publicity?
Oh, God. I mean, if anybody... Go listen. I mean, these boring old farts, man, you know, boring... What? Don't move on?
Yes.
All right. I'll have to check. I don't know if anybody's emailed us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
I will be able to get online eventually. They're putting in a new computer here for me. But otherwise, I'm of no use to you when it comes to emails during the show.
All right. We were talking about email and just email bankruptcy, where people have just taken their, like, 46,000 inbox emails and deleting them. And also about Fox News, where people that watch Fox News regularly were worse informed and were less accurately able to describe news events than people that didn't watch news at all. Also, the drug war. Can you imagine this? That world leaders, including ex-United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, said that the decades-long war on drugs has failed and the world's lawmakers need to consider decriminalization. Echoing that was disgraced Governor Chris Christie. I don't know if he's been disgraced yet, but he's in a lot of trouble. He will not be the Republican nominee. They'll get some whack job like Huckabee.
Oh, great.
President Huckabee? Yeah, well, that's not going to fly anywhere outside of the South, let me tell you that.
He already tried that.
Yeah. All right. And I was going to tell you, too, but we're going to do a little Eat the Rich segment, but Tim in Lincoln Park. Tim in Lincoln Park has been waiting patiently. Let's get him on the air. Tim, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. How are you doing tonight?
We're good.
Good. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, I like this story about the whole media and how much people are informed and misinformed. I guess my take on it is that all the major media, pretty much all of it, including respectable institutions like the New York Times, Washington Post, the Detroit Free Press, I mean, they're basically corporate-owned. So even where you get, and you do get a lot of good stories in a lot of these papers, you still have sort of a corporate slant and a corporate drive behind the kind of the paradigm of the news.
Sure.
That's not to say that people are misinformed, but they might still not get kind of the whole picture of what's going on. As for the Fox types, I mean, that's pure raw propaganda. There's nothing of value on Fox, nothing at all. And for those people that consider it some sort of a balanced and fair organization, I mean, listen, this is Roger Ailes' baby. He wanted to do this during the Nixon administration. He wanted to have a total GOP TV, and he got it. It's total Republican crap. It's the Tea Party. It's Republican. It's right wing. And it's a lie upon lie. I mean, they don't even make any pretense about telling the truth on Fox. So anybody who wants to sort of try to figure out what's going on, they need to just get off Fox completely. They're a piece of junk.
Hey, Tim, do you ever watch it? I never do. I mean, once in a while,
I can't take it.
Remember when Tony Snow was alive? He became Bush's press secretary.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I used to sort of watch him in the morning just to kind of see. This was before the Gulf War, you know, had begun, and I kind of got enough of it. I mean, he wasn't as bad even as O'Reilly is and so on, but I was like, okay, this guy, he sort of gave me kind of a window onto the whole right-wing propaganda stuff. And after that, I just sort of dropped off. I mean,
mm-hmm. Well, do you know who Robert Jensen is? He's a journalism professor from University of Texas at Austin. He's on a lot of talk shows. I've interviewed him any number of times. And he appears on it. He goes, like, head-to-head with, like, O'Reilly. And I said, Bob, why the hell do you bother to do it? And he says, I got to believe 10% of the listeners of Fox News are... have the opposite, either are neutral and want to see what's going on, or have a left perspective, and they say they want to.
I know a lot of people who have told me that.
Yeah, I know.
I think it's diminishing returns because.
Me too.
Because as I see it, if you're either semi-objective or let's say liberal, you know, you're just sort of seen there as sort of a circus monkey on Fox.
That's what I think.
They cut off microphones. They yell at them. They belittle them. They deny the authenticity of their stories or their opinions. So I love Bob Jensen. I've heard him on several interviews.
He's great.
But I think he's doing a disservice to himself. I mean, just you know,
stay out of the rat race, right?
Hey, Tim, you probably, you know, I know you're a longtime listener to the show, so you've probably heard this before. The old saying that if you're standing on a corner talking to a fool, the passerby can't tell who the fool is.
Right.
Right.
Well,
hey,
it's true.
Did you hear who is? All the networks were up for an interview with President Obama on Super Bowl Sunday. Did you hear who got it?
No.
Bill O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly's going to interview.
Yes. Yeah, well, who got the... I mean, sometimes it's a pool situation. When I was a television news reporter, we had a pool, and I won the pool, and I interviewed Hillary Clinton.
Huh?
So sometimes it's that kind of situation. I don't know how they do it.
Bill O'Reilly's my union brother, by the way.
Well, okay. Let's take Bill O'Reilly as an example. Now, if he really wanted to be critical of Barack Obama, seriously, right, he could ask him about his position on TPP and Keystone. I mean, that's something you can analyze and go, okay, why does Barack Obama support TPP? Why does he support Keystone? Why does he support a grand bargain to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? Now, those questions are legitimate, but this bullshit, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that.
That's okay.
But this nonsense that Barack Obama, you know, he was born in Kenya. I mean, that has no...
He's not going to ask him that. In fact, I'd be very curious because what Fox News depends on is, as you've been saying, this utter distortion of reality. And Bill O'Reilly, who supports, what is it, Trans-Pacific...
Partnership, yeah.
Partnership, which will be like, NAFTA on steroids, as they say. Yeah, I'm sure he supports that. I'm sure he thinks that's an excellent thing. And I'm sure, what's he going to do? Quiz him about his drone warfare? Of course not. So I'm going to be very curious. All right, Tim, thank you very much.
Okay, take it easy.
Always good talking to you. Some open lines for you.
We took care of that, Tim. Don't worry.
What? Oh, yeah.
Carry on.
Let's see. Here, I got to get the off button. There we go. Some open lines at 248-544-WRIF. All right, Jalene, this always startles you, so don't let it startle you.
Oh, thank you for the warning.
All right, it's our Eat the Rich segment, and why not? Turnabout Fair Play, right? They're eating us big time because as the 1% of the world engorges itself with the fruits of the labor of the lower 6 or 7 billion people, we're talking, what, how many people, that upper 1%, or even the 1%. In fact, maybe I shouldn't say that because the 1% of the world, very possible many of us are in the 1% of the world, but who really controls it is that 0.1% at the top of this country and also of the world. So what happens when folks want a night out, a little, maybe take the wife to a hotel, you know, get away from the kids and spend a nice night, perhaps at the Jewel Suite at the New York Palace, which is at Madison and 51st. Nice walking distance to the Museum of Modern Art and Central Park and everything like that. One of two recently opened specialty suites. This is a three-story, 5,000-square-foot space. So this is bigger than your house and my house combined, right?
Yeah.
A sort of penthouse Versailles. Yeah, it's, you know, the palace at, where the French kings lived. And what happened to them? Oh, yeah. Right. Anyway, it resembles a jewel box, one with a private elevator and views of the Empire State and Chrysler buildings. Big deal.
It sounds lovely.
The floor in the entryway on the 53rd floor is glittering black marble arranged in a sunburst pattern while a 20-foot crystal chandelier hangs from the ceiling. The living room sofa is a brilliant sapphire blue and tufted ivory chase. It has a pearlescent sheen. Two floors up in a second-story living room next to a vast private terrace, the wet bar, one of the two in the suite and half bath, are swathed in a sparkling wall covering, and an angular lavender sofa calls to mind an amethyst crystal. Iridescent tiles lining the private rooftop hot tub give the impression of sinking into a giant opal. And then there's the jewels themselves. More than $1 million of jewelry designer's work is displayed in five museum-like cases in the entryway and a boudoir area in the master suite.
What a waste of space.
Yeah. So take a guess how much a night.
Oh, let's see. I'm going to say $50,000.
Oh. Well, you'd go there then.
$25,000. Right.
$25,000 a night.
Okay. Well, you know, it's a lot.
In New York, the race to capture the highest end of the market continues. In November, the Mandarin Oriental New York opened a 3,300-square-foot suite that includes floor-to-ceiling windows and a dining room that seats 28,000 a year. I'm sorry, a night.
Yeah.
28,000 a night.
Okay.
What do I do when you're not here? People are probably thinking, what the hell is this guy talking about? This trend of super suites had overseas antecedents with the demand driven by a growing cadre of the ultra-rich from around the world. And one of the people said, in the end, the rich are getting richer, and the hotels are looking to serve them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to have some pretty big coin to splurge on that.
And you might drive up in, like this guy, Matt Hlavin, an entrepreneur in Cleveland who owns seven businesses, and he bought three Mercedes last year, a 237,000 SLS AMG and a $165,000 S63 AMG for himself and a 97,000 GL550 sport utility vehicle for the wife.
Oh, well, lucky
she's down
wifey.
Yeah. And this is going on 55% sales increase this year, followed by double-digit gains from Rolls-Royce, Jaguar, Lamborghini, Porsche, and Bentley, according to figures from the Autodata Corporation. Many of the brands sold more cars in the first 11 months of 2013 than they did in all of 2007 before the recession. So they're doing great up there. And we said last week, half the members of Congress are millionaires. And on the low end, though, when people try to get something like $15 an hour that they voted in SeaTac, Washington, a suburb of Seattle, the Chamber of Commerce goes to court to stop people from getting that so that they will have a market-determined wage, which, who knows? I mean, there's the artificial wage of the minimum wage, because a market wage would be what? Would probably be about $2 or $3 an hour. Yeah, and we'd all could. I was just watching, to be nice to my wife, I was watching Downton Abbey, and there was this guy talking to the Lord, and he had his cap in his hand. You know, he'd hold it with both hands and say, yeah, me Lord. And we could thatch our roofs and go back to that and say, you know, thank you, sir.
Oh, yeah, and then the numbers of just sheer numbers of homeless people in this country alone, it's shameful.
And states are cutting their weeks of aid to the jobless because these Republicans, these conservatives, say that this encourages people to stay on unemployment. The unemployment, you know.
That is such a load of crap.
You know, people that need help should get help. People that need help should get help. So I'm not disparaging welfare, but welfare seems to be in a category lower than unemployment because the unemployment insurance people paid into. So there's at least something there where you're getting back the money you and your employer put in. But like I say, I'm not trying to disparage people that need assistance. And you got to remember, during, say, the 1830s and 40s in this country, I don't know why we always talk about Dickens in England, it was no different here. I mean, the life, many ways, the life of industrial workers in, say, the Northeast, where industrialism first took off, in many ways was worse and more deadly to the spirit and the body than slavery. And, I mean, they're both horrible. Industrial.
I don't know. That seems a little.
Well, I don't want to go into a whole thing.
Completely different.
Different things. Slavery is probably one of the most awful things that probably.
I'm not a fan of that analogy at all.
Okay.
But
well,
I get what you're trying to say.
Here's what I'm saying. That then men were working 12 and 14 hours a day.
Yeah.
And 52 weeks a year. The conditions under which they worked shortened their life such
but they weren't being beaten and separated from their families.
No, that's horrible. That's all horrible. Well, they, yeah, they were.
Ripped out of their homeland.
Yeah, no. I mean, nothing compares to that, without a doubt. I mean, maybe it's wrong. It's like a lot of people don't like the Holocaust used for anything other than what happened to European Jewry. And in other words, you could want to say there was a Holocaust in Rwanda. Or
right.
in Cambodia.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. So maybe it's but let me put it this way. They were both destroyed people.
Yeah.
And it was only, and so left to the tender mercies of the market and the individual capitalist, it was just hell on earth. Just like left to the tender mercies of the slavers, it was who ruined this country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and whose insistence on slavery in the Constitution and whose insistence on the Second Amendment so they could maintain their slave patrols and what have you.
It's a lot more than guns.
And they're institutionalizing racial differences are one of the reasons that I don't even, sometimes, I don't mean to sound hopeless, but sometimes I get hopeless about our situations ever, ever being solved.
Oh, I do too. Yeah, for sure. But it doesn't mean we aren't going to keep fighting.
No, absolutely. So in the meantime, you have these states which are beginning to cut off aid to extended aid to the jobless. And here's an article. It's so heartbreaking. This is in Riegelwood, North Carolina, the New York Times a couple of days ago. After losing her job as a security guard in June, Elnetta McKnight turned to food stamps and unemployment insurance to support herself and her 14-year-old son. But her jobless payments ran out after 20 weeks, and now they are living on close to nothing. Got to remember, these people, because of the Republicans, the conservatives, that got, they didn't want to conserve that. The only thing they want to conserve is the worst in American life and always have. That unless someone can tell me, what have the conservatives ever brought about that improved this country?
Are you still trying to get that answer?
No one ever does, yeah.
We never get an answer.
Here's what Ms. McKnight said. I worked for 26 years. I lost my job through no fault of my own. Sitting in her darkened living room, she keeps the lights off to save money. And in this small town, which is about 20 miles from Wilmington, North Carolina. And she says, this is what I get. Had Ms. McKnight been laid off a year earlier, she almost certainly would have qualified for more than a year of unemployment insurance payments, helping keep her family out of poverty while she sought another position. But last July, North Carolina sharply cut its unemployment program, reducing the maximum number of weeks of benefits to 20 from 73 weeks, and reducing the maximum weekly benefit as well. The rest of the country is now following North Carolina's lead. That is in the states that are being run by conservative Republicans that hate poor people. The idea that there are people in the working class or the poor that support these social monsters is so far beyond me. And I'm sorry that the idea that we're not all part of a community and that somehow you can make up these lies that these people should go out and find jobs, that jobs aren't there. And they know this. They know this.
They just don't care.
But you know what they do? For one thing, they're individually mean-spirited people, but they know they are playing to a base of mean-spirited people.
Yeah.
And this is how they get elected.
And what are these people supposed to do? I mean, honestly, this is going to result in more homeless people, shelters for women and children filling up more. They're going to have to build more shelters. I mean, it's awful. If something happened to me, for example, I'd be okay because I have family. I have family that would be able to help me. You know, I could call up Peter Werby.
don't come by my house, girl. No, you could, of course.
But, you know, these are people who have absolutely nothing. They were probably born into a lower income family, and their family members don't have anything either. It's a hopeless situation.
Hey, I know a guy. Remember I was talking earlier about Albert Young and the Straight Eight singing that song 52 and Unemployed?
Yeah.
I know a guy. Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. He's 62. Typical, downward mobility from somebody in the middle class. He was a building contract supervisor. Lost his job, couldn't get rehired, his marriage fell apart, his unemployment ran out, and now he has zero income. And he's living with his parents.
Yeah, that's so sad.
He's 62 years old. You know how old his parents must be?
Oh, right. Yeah. They're 80s.
Anyway, the rest of the country now following North Carolina's lead, cutting back on unemployment. A federal program supplying extra weeks of benefits to the long-term unemployed expired at the end of 2013, and congressional Democrats failed in an attempt to revive it. The reason they failed is because these conservative Republicans opposed it. About 1.3 million jobless workers received their last payment on December 28th. Starting on January 1st, the maximum period of unemployment benefits payments dropped to 26 weeks in most states, down from as much as 73. All right, to those conservatives that are listening, what should these people do? You know what? I don't think you have a single answer.
Yeah.
I don't think you have a single answer. Yeah, but we're here for you.
Their only answer is getting government aid, which is what these people go crazy about anyway.
Well, they don't. Yeah.
So in the process of cutting these people off, they're having to rely.
Well, they don't know nothing. They're not getting government aid at all. They're not available. If you're 62 years old, you're able-bodied, you're not eligible for anything.
Even if you have no paycheck?
Well, you can begin actually at 62. I think he may have done this, start to take reduced Social Security benefits.
Yeah. Mm.
But that's going up as well. So, dear conservative friends and listeners, what should somebody do in that regard?
And do you even care?
Yeah. Well, you're
will you admit it?
Yeah. We will talk about all of that and more when we come back. Get your calls at 248-544-WRIF.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Hurry to Verizon for the trade-in and trade-up smartphone sale. For a limited time, trade in your smartphone and get a $100, $200, or even $300 gift card towards a new smartphone depending on the value of your trade-in. All on America's largest and most reliable 4G LTE network. Trading up to the reliable network you deserve. That's powerful. Verizon. Click the banner to shop now. Requires new 2-year activation. Trade-in must be in good working condition. Gift card takes up to 2 weeks from receipt of trade-in.
Listen up, everybody. This is Flo with a Progressive Insurance Alert. Don't even try to change that channel. I'm on all of them. So, you already know Snapshot rewards our customers for their good driving. Well, now anyone can test drive Snapshot for free, even if you have insurance with another company. See how much you could save before you switch your insurance. Also, I'm offering kazoo lessons on Saturdays.
Test drive Snapshot today. Visit progressive.com/snapshot. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Snapshot not available in all states.
Whether it's a serious fall, fire danger, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company with its slogan, "Help, I've fallen and I can't get up," protects its members. Here are some of them.
When you have a heart attack like I did and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Now, Life Alert can also protect you in a fire emergency with a system that automatically notifies our monitoring center.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can avoid or delay going into a nursing facility. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now, 1-800-404-2454. That's 1-800-404-2454. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure at 1-800-404-2454.
I'm
going to
rock the house.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Everything that rocks.
I want to hit the revolution out there. I want to hear another revolution. Show the resistance. It's time to testify. I want to know. Are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you.
Peter and Jalene. You're listening to Night Call, the Rift award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
248-544-WRIF is our phone number.
And that is 248-544-9743.
And I forgot about all of our emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I don't know if I can get to them all, but let's see here. I never should do it on
your
the fly.
Cold reading.
Oh, yeah. Michael writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We were playing the Crocus song, Eat the Rich, and then talking about why the rich should be eaten, because they're eating us. He said, I think it's a very good idea to keep an eye on the super rich this way. It should be more commonplace to do so.
Yeah.
What?
Like more people should check them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Oh, I thought
he's saying good on you.
Yeah.
Too bad more people don't keep a close eye like that.
Okay, I see. I got it. All right. Mm-hmm. So one more here. sorry, Billy, I can't read this one on the air.
Is it our Billy?
No.
Oh, okay.
But I can't disparage.
I gotta look at it.
I sometimes do disparage this particular, advertiser, but
hey,
not directly.
We hear you, man.
I feel you.
Feel you, dog.
All right. So I was asking, are there any conservatives out there that have any suggestions of what should be done with these people who now have no income. They were fired from their job for no fault of their own because of a contracting economy due to Reaganomics and Bush's recession. There is no way in the world that that it could have been, I don't know, fixed in the manner that that President Obama has tried to do with the kind of Republican obstructionism. And so what are they supposed to do? What is your advice? If you're a conservative, you know, you're not going to call because you don't have a single word of certainly not of compassion, but a suggestion. Because
I dare you. I dare
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I dare you. Because, I don't know, how about, well, at 1 o'clock, I'm going to be interviewing Michael Stephen Smith, who's written a book, well, edited a book, actually, with a couple of other people called Imagine a Socialist America. So this wouldn't happen in a socialist America. There's one solution. What's yours, Mr. Conservative? Right. Did you, we just wanted a little comic relief,
oh,
though.
Oh, old pal George Zimmerman is
back.
Yeah,
the killer.
This guy has cojones the size of very large boulders.
Yeah.
This is, it says, it's a case of art imitating life that just might hit too close to home. In case you've forgotten, because we are in such a compartmentalized, move on to the next subject, society, he is the man who was acquitted of in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin.
Unarmed.
Now he's
Trayvon Martin. Deemed,
yes, unarmed, armed with candy.
Yeah.
Zimmerman claims himself to be an artist
yeah.
of sorts, and he, let's see. Okay, the AP has accused George Zimmerman of copyright infringement, demanding that he cease the planned sale of a recent painting of Florida State Attorney Angela Corey. She was the attorney who prosecuted Zimmerman in the trial for the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. And it says Zimmerman clearly directly copied an AP photo to create his painting of the attorney Angela Corey. He fired back via his Twitter account on Friday, threatening to sue the AP. Why doesn't he just shut up?
Yeah, and why? This guy that
he
is.
He needs to go in hiding.
Yeah, he does.
Find that Casey Anthony, and those two can hang out together.
What's the quote on there? There's this quote on there. It says, I have this much respect for the American judicial system with this sort of solarized, I think the process is called, like you do in Photoshop or something like that. So he took this Associated Press photo.
I'm looking right at
and
it.
And just did it and solarized it and then put this, it sounds like a quote, and it's not. She never said that. So this guy,
he's saying it, isn't it? He said it as it was a quote?
Well, it looks like it's got her name under it,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Does.
So, yeah.
Oh, my.
Okay, let's get back to the phones, and let's pick up here on Paul in Livonia, which is, I forgot, what is it backwards? Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Paul, Anoville?
Anoville, yeah,
oh,
Paul from Anoville. Go ahead, Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah, I tend to think the greatest threats to this country and the world, for that matter, are those that vote in Republican Party primaries, because these are basically the most insecure, screwed-up people walking around, and they simply support the con artists whose only interests are to benefit those that are, you know, the billionaires and military-industrial complex.
Oh, are you Congress? Are you talking about members of Congress?
No, I'm talking about those that vote. And the Republican primaries are the greatest threat to this country because they vote for those con artists that run for office, Republican Party.
In the Republican Party, well, what are you suggesting? That people don't vote or that they vote for the Democratic Party?
I'm just saying they is because of their self-centeredness and their viewpoint on life, they vote for these, in the primaries, they vote for those that really are only to benefit the special interest groups, the billionaires and the military-industrial complex. If the Republicans get back in control of the White House, in Congress, we're going to see an attack on Iran eventually that could take us to the brink of World War III. So that's not good either.
Well, a lot of people.
Just more people need to vote.
I don't know what would happen if the right wing conservative agenda actually got some expression became laws. I don't know. I mean, there might be a revolution. What are you going to do? You're actually going to take millions and millions of people that that are living in a contracting job world. You know, people say, well, you know, it's growing and all that, but it's not really. And the jobs that are there are increasingly lower paid. You know, the right wing is trying to destroy unions, which is part of the. I mean, it's the only organized political force in this country, the union movement, that has the interests of the middle class, the working class, and the poor at heart, and forces the Democratic Party, which can be as corporatist as the Republicans at times, to take up the agenda of ordinary people. And the conservatives are all about destroying that with everything they do. Whenever you look into a lot of their policies, when you know their attacks on the post office, their attacks on public workers, it's all about destroying the base of the Democratic Party. All right, thank you very much, Paul.
Yeah,
I appreciate
workers,
your call.
Retired city workers and their pensions.
Sure. Let's see, here is Jesse. Jesse's in Royal Oak. Jesse, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter, Jolene.
Hi.
How you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Good. Hi, Jesse.
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to call and just kind of get your thoughts on, you know, some of the blight in the city of Detroit and abandoned buildings, and there's been, like, a lot of media attention towards it, you know, with the bankruptcy and...
Sure. What's your thought? I mean, what motivated the question?
Well, I actually get tours to a lot of these abandoned buildings in Detroit, like organized scheduled tours.
Wait a minute, you're not the guy that was in the Sunday paper today, are you?
I am. Yeah. Yep.
Oh.
You know, let me tell you funny.
Our papers never came today. I need to read it online.
I want to hear about this. But you know, Jesse, it's interesting. So I get the most amount of news possible. I subscribe to the Sunday New York Times, not to the Sunday, and I'll ask you in a second, the News of the Free Press, that an article was there about you. And by accident, they delivered that paper, and I was reading that. So you take people from literally from all around the world on sort of fabulous ruins tours, right?
I do, yeah. It's,
you go to the Packard plant.
No, he goes in the... Go ahead. Tell us where you go.
Well, you know, since I've been doing this, I've probably been to, like, over 180 different buildings and, you know, hundreds of different tours, you know, scheduled organized tours, and it's, you know, it's about the history of the building. It's about the, you know, the architecture, the art that's there, and it's about... photography too. It's about, you know, it's what I do for a living. You know, I go in and I capture these pictures and you know, it's creating an opportunity and being able to help people with their photography. So it's not, you know, people look at it as like it's a bad thing, but I feel it's kind of creates awareness.
I think it's great. I'd like to go.
Yeah. You know,
and it's definitely fun.
Are you familiar with a website which is actually called The Fabulous Ruins of Detroit?
Not exactly, no.
Well, you know, you ought to check that out because it's run by a friend of mine, Lowell Boileau. If you're listening, Lowell, hi. He often listens. And, in fact, in my living room, I have one of his photographs of the old Grandy ballroom lit just with, you know, the old rock and roll ballroom that's lit just from a big hole in the ceiling. And So you guys have a tremendous amount in common. You ought to hook up with him. Lowell, if you're listening, call up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a great place, but it's like about the history and the energy you get from it and going there. I mean, there's so many great bands, you know, rock and roll bands that, you know, toured through there and came through there. That was the place to go to.
The Grandy. Well, how many?
To see a rock venue, you know, and I do get lots of requests. People say, oh, I want to go to that ballroom, you know.
Do you go there?
And I take them there, yeah.
They can get
they
in.
They should see it.
And what about some of the others on the east side, like the Cinderella Ballroom and the Harpo's?
Harpo's is still there.
Oh, is it still got mm-hmm. still a music venue?
It's up for sale, actually. Harpo's is up for sale right now.
Wow.
But I mean, like the East Town Theater, you know, that was a big rock and roll venue. You know, Alice Cooper, you know, Ted Nugent. I mean, a lot of bands rolled through there, too.
All of the I forgot what album, but the Jay Giles Band recorded a live album at Cinderella Ballroom. Yeah, so wait a minute. Let me ask you, Jesse. This is kind of like something you can hook onto. People can like you got a.
How do we find you?
Yeah, how do we find you?
It's Motor City Photography Workshops. I currently run it through Meetup.com. It's kind of a place for people to host meetups, get-togethers, that kind of thing. I do have a website, and if you just Google, you know, Motor City Photography Workshops, it's gonna kind of come up right on top, and it's. You know, it's exciting. I mean, people should have an opportunity to do this.
Will you take Peter and I on a tour?
I would, yes.
That would be wonderful.
I've had a lot of interest from the media, like with the auto show coming in town. I did a media tour. We had a van load of media, and, you know, they interviewed and we went out on the streets. I got to meet the new owner of the Packard, Fernando. We just happened to be driving by. I had a Anadoli news agency with me, and they were kind of doing a tour and an interview. And
the new Packard owner, did you hear that?
Yeah, I know, it's been fun.
We pulled up, and they did like a little short piece with him. I shook his hand and met him, and yeah, so it's...
All right, well,
did he talk about any of his plans for the Packard plant?
A little bit. I know he wants to be living there by his 59th birthday, which is...
Living there,
in, like in April, which that's probably not going to happen, but it's
wow. You know,
there's a lot of other stuff that goes on, you know, with people going to look at these locations. There's a lot of scrapping going on. That seems to be the biggest problem. Scrapping.
People just stripping these buildings of silver,
copper,
and whatever.
Did you? I'm sure you've seen that video of those skiers.
People skiing inside the Packard plant.
And all over it. Have you seen that?
Packard, St. Agnes, that's pretty cool. Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah, people, if you haven't seen that, folks, I think it was on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, and you can kind of just scroll down and find it, or just...
That'll probably take you a while. Just Google.
Google skiing in Packard plant, and you got it. Yeah, I mean, It is astounding.
It is.
Well, Jesse, I've got a whole lot of other callers I want to get to, but we can get to you one more time. Motor City
Photography
Workshop.
Workshop.
Okay, you're going to hear from us.
Yeah, hit me up and we'll set up a tour and I'll take you guys out.
All right, thank you. I'm going to hook you up with my friend Lowell with the Fabulous Ruins of Detroit. You can Google that as well. All right, thanks. I'm glad you got a hold of us.
Nice.
How coincidental. All right. We asked earlier, given the nature of this economy where Reaganomics finally crashed in 2007 and created the situation that we're in, and there's not enough that the government can do because of Republican obstructionism to create a vibrant economy that includes everybody. I mean, people say the recession is over. That's because all the rich people got more and more money and they can stay in $28,000 a night hotel rooms and what have you. But what happens to the people whose unemployment runs out and have no income at all? And I ask if there's any conservatives, what is their advice? What is their solution to this? And here's Andy from Manchester. Andy, hi, you're on the air. So what do we say to people that now have no income?
As far as that goes, I mean, there's plenty of job websites. I just moved back to Michigan a few months back, and within a couple, like a month and a half, I found a job that started off at $15 an hour.
What, doing what?
It's a distribution center.
So you think that anyone who wants to find a job could?
It is I had my challenges on finding a job. I won't lie. I did have my challenge, but they are out there. I think part of the problem is there's a whole market of jobs that people think about looking at?
Well, so the answer is yes. You think that there's enough jobs for everybody, and that if people, I mean, this is essentially what Paul Ryan And what's his name, that crazy senator from Kentucky, Ron Paul, Ron's son, think that that actually what's happening with unemployment insurance is that it accustoms people to not working, and why should we work if we're getting $325 a week from the government? And if they really wanted to, they could go find a job. Yes?
Partly. I do know people that have abused the system pretty bad. And those people I do have a strong disregard for.
Well, you know, in any huge bureaucracy, people, there's always somebody scamming. Little, you know, the scams on food stamps, which are fairly insignificant, the ones of unemployment insurance, which are fairly insignificant, I mean, are nothing that pale compared to the banksters that sank the economy of this country. Or the, you know, these people, they get, like some of the banks, they're getting fines for what they did, like $2 billion, I think, or even more, maybe $14 billion, which is nothing to these folks. So the real misbehavior in the economic sphere is not somebody who's scamming $325 a week, which is fairly insignificant in terms of the overall number of people that are doing it. Yeah, you know what? I've known people that have scammed government programs. Probably everybody knows somebody that has done a little something. Or we all do. People that don't report all their income because they get paid in cash. Or that under report their tips if they're weight people,
right,
and all that.
Except musicians.
Yeah, musicians, says Janine.
But then, you know, you also have to consider that everyone's circumstances are different. And, I mean, on so many levels, for instance, they could have transportation issues.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, what I should tell this 62-year-old guy is get a job.
Well, no, I have no problem against or with people who legitimately, honorably use the systems that are out there for what they're for. I have a problem against people who are conning the system, using it, manipulating it.
Well, I think we all do that. And I want to say, and don't let me finish so you don't take this in the wrong way. I'm actually kind of disappointed in this call, because you're actually saying what most of us think. If people shouldn't con the system, and if people have a legitimate need for aid and through no fault of their own, like the woman I was, who just got laid off. And
yeah.
So, okay, we're there.
And the other part that you have to throw in there is that these people who are allegedly bucking the system, no pun intended, they're not living the high life, okay? They're not making a lot of money if they're doing that or not. It's not a living in a lap of luxury by any means.
Yeah. One of the ways...
They're still hungry.
It's one of the ways, Andy, it's interesting you said you're making $15 an hour, because that's what people now consider to be a minimum living wage, not the, which is like twice as much as the actual minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And if that was offered, I mean, here you could test the theory whether there actually are jobs that people could apply for, is have that be the standard. $15 an hour as the living wage, and see how many people apply. Well, I'm sure you'd probably have, like if there's one job, you could actually, and you've seen this before, have 4,000 people lined up for it.
Yeah.
All right, Andy, thank you very much. I got to move along. I appreciate your call very much. And here is Ron in Shelby Township. Hey, Ron. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon. Everybody's going to think this is a recorded.
For a while. When I
this is not a recorded show, folks. This wasn't recorded this afternoon. Go ahead.
When I called in, you were asking people were calling about who watch the mainstream media news.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say that I haven't listened to TV in probably about 3-4 years now.
Congratulations. That's good.
I have not simply because my TV is out, okay, and I know the mainstream media news, the corporate news, is nothing but lies and deception. I'm talking ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, CNN, etc.
Wait. Let's extend the et cetera.
Fox. Oh, that's ABC. That's ABC. Wait, isn't that ABC here?
No. But it's Fox.
Well,
it's
Fox.
The local channel is different than Fox yeah. News.
Well, anyway,
the national
I don't
channel.
Listen to any of the corporate news, and I am probably more informed than most people out here because I simply listen to the GCN independent radio networks. And if you listen to one of their programs just once, I guarantee you, Peter, Julie, that it will open your eyes big time. And I want to ask you a question, Peter.
Sure.
Do you know who Joyce Riley is?
Joyce Riley. Have you mentioned her before?
Yes. Well, Joyce Riley was a nurse.
Yeah?
She was Echo. The nurse that blew the whistle on Jeanette Jones. Do you know who Jeanette Jones is?
On Jeanette Jones?
Not her. Not Jeanette.
No, yeah. We don't know. We're kidding.
Jeanette Jones, this is big back in 86, 87. Jeanette Jones was the nurse in Bexar County Hospital in Texas that killed all of those babies.
Oh.
And I, Peter, I have something very important that I would like to get out to the public
sure.
for help, okay, because time is running short, okay? Jeanette Jones is supposed to get out of prison in 2017, okay? 2017. Yeah. And when she was convicted, state law said that in 30 years that they have to release her, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And there are many people, over 100 babies that were killed by this woman.
How come they didn't execute her?
She's still in prison. She's still in prison. And state law then said that in 30 years they have to release her. Okay.
Tell me her name again. I'm
Jeanette
sorry.
Jeanette Jones. Let's look it up here.
We'll look it up.
And the people are crying out for help across this country. If anybody, there's a group of lawyers that want to put her away, that can put her away for life if they bring another case against her. And what they are looking for is anybody out there that knows a family member or friend or relative, anybody that had a baby killed, murdered in the hospital in Texas back in the 80s, to come forward. Please come forward because time is running out, and they want to put this woman away for life.
Gotcha.
How did she do it?
Well,
she was a nurse.
She was a nurse, okay?
Yeah.
And what she
no,
did...
I know that part.
What she did was... She wanted to get attention, okay, that
sorry,
that she was really good. And what she would do is give a baby this chemical. I forget the name. It's a
no
name
matter.
That you can't pronounce, okay. But it's a chemical that they use in the operating room to stop your stop you from breathing. But it's perfectly safe. Everything else functions. And it's used only in the operating room when they have to stop your breathing. And then there's an antidote that they give you, and it starts you up again. And this nurse snuck these babies in and then pretended that they were going into cardiac arrest or something and then slip them a doctor. You know, she'd say, doctor, I know what's wrong. And she'd give them the antidote, you know.
Okay.
The doctor wasn't looking, and she would be deemed as a hero.
Well, we'll look into that.
Yeah, we'll look into that. All right, as usual, thank you for a very interesting call. I appreciate it. I just Googled Jeanette Jones and came up with absolutely nothing. Looks like a couple of entertainers.
You need to Google Jeanette Jones baby killer. I don't need to laugh.
Yeah. All right. Wait. Can you hold on? Well, all right. Let's.
We'll do it at the commercial break.
Yeah. We'll get. Here is.
I've never heard of this.
Here's Mary in Livonia, which backwards are. Do you mind us saying what Livonia is back?
Anoville.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, Peter, you get too much joy out of this. God.
I think it's hilarious as well because it's so fitting.
Oh, God.
But I just wanted to tell you a statistic I heard this week about the world's 85 richest people have the same wealth as 3.5 billion poorest.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
B with a billion.
Yeah, we've been saying that, but we put it in a little bit different terms, Peter. What was it, 2%? The top 2% have as much as...
But that's 85 people, Julian.
Right, oh, I know. I'm surprised it's that many, actually.
I was actually looking for... Oh, yeah, yeah, here... I don't know. I usually have this here, but somehow I can't find it. Yeah, I mean, it's astounding how many... how few people have so much money.
That statistic blew me away. And also on that Texas governor...
Yeah. Rick Perry?
Yeah, you know how he wants to keep drugs illegal or what have you?
Right.
But he's also in the state that has the strictest abortion laws, but they have the death penalty and kill more people in the state. And, it really makes sense to me.
Oh, yeah, I know. They really get a kick out of putting people down there.
Yeah,
and as you can imagine, with the death penalty, many innocent people have been executed. All right, well, thank you.
And allow free access to women for health care.
Well, the Republicans continuing with their war on women, that's for sure. All right.
That's a fact.
Thank you, Mary.
Guys.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Mary.
Bye-bye. And I was thinking, remember, should we even bring this up, last week when someone said, they said, Jolene, just keep your legs closed. And
I don't know why they were talking to me.
Yeah.
About me.
Well, Mike Huckabee, there cannot be.
I'm no spring chicken.
There could be. You're a cougar.
I don't even think I could have a baby if I tried right now.
But don't bother taking her advice then.
okay, I'm not going
there
to.
There cannot be a President Huckabee.
There
can. I mean, it
is
that's
it
like
the name?
What is it? Oh, you know, Mike Huckabee.
Yeah.
The ex-governor of Arkansas.
Yeah.
Didn't he do something good? He pardoned Keith Richards for a drug bust.
I don't remember.
Years ago. But generally, he's pretty awful, and he continued. Now, the Republicans are going crazy trying to tamp down all the whack job racists and anti-gay.
The Republicans are?
Well, yeah, because they realize they're alienating so many sectors of the population.
So kind of separating themselves from the Tea Party more than anything.
And not just gay people. I mean, it's not like they think, I'm not even convinced that they think that if they, well, they're mostly after women. They want to bring women back into the Republican Party. But they're trying to stop these incredible, I mean, they have, you said it years and years ago, political Tourette's.
Oh, yeah. They can't help themselves.
The Tourette's syndrome is when you swear. You can't control your swearing. Well, they can't control their utterances.
Their hatred.
Hatred, yeah. So it's, I would suspect, or maybe this isn't even intentional because they're so crazed and so they're always frothing about something, that, sure, they want to bring women back. They would absolutely don't think they can bring people of color back either. I mean, what they want to do is cut into the margins, particularly of Hispanics. But if they could, African-Americans as well, gays, whatever, what they want to appeal to is young voters. No, they don't think that. Young voters. Because young voters, they don't have the prejudices that these angry old white that are the base of the Republican Party.
They're not tainted.
So what they want to, they don't want to show, like, I don't have the name in front of me, the guy who was the Republican National Delegate who made these anti-gay and anti-Muslim remarks and has been told by every Republican in Michigan to resign. And he refuses to do it. Mm-hmm. So they're realizing that their intolerance, which is part of the base of the Republican Party's built-in DNA, intolerance, lack of compassion, all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, what wasn't it Bush's pappy that said, we're talking about compassionate conservatives? I mean, talk about a contradiction in terms.
Yeah. And are you going to touch on the Martin Luther King thing?
I'm not, but let me know. I want to actually touch on Mike Huckabee, whose comments about contraception proved quick fodder for Democrats and a headache for Republicans trying to market themselves as a better choice for female voters who have proved elusive to the Republican Party. Boy, that sentence is so loaded. Quick fodder, F-O-D-D-E-R, like feed for the Democrats. It's not for the Democrats. Maybe the Democrats tried to jump on it, but it's for women who get an idea of where these right-wingers are coming from, trying to market themselves. It's not a belief, right? They want to market it. Anyway, the former Arkansas governor and potential presidential contender told fellow Republicans on Thursday that Democrats were trying to win over female voters by promising them birth control and telling them they cannot manage, quote, their libido or their reproductive system.
Did you say Democrats? Said Democrats.
He said that the Democrats were trying to win over female voters by telling them they cannot manage, quote, their libido or their reproductive system without the help of the government. And the reason for this is that the national health care law says that insurers have to provide contraception as part of the policy.
Right.
So I don't know if it's in here or not. Let's see, who is saying this? Oh, well, here's what Huckabee said. If the Democrats want to insult the women of America by making them believe that they are hopeless without Uncle Sugar coming in and providing them with their prescription each month for birth control because they cannot control their libido or their reproductive system without the help of the government, then so be it. This is, what they think. I mean,
it's amazing. With all the issues in the world, oh, my gosh.
Somewhere in here.
Why do they have to keep picking on us?
Yeah, I don't know. But there's someone that's saying that when you start getting below the surface of abortion questions, you start understanding these people are against contraception as well. And actually what they are, they're the anti-sex party. Wasn't there a 1984 Orwell's book, The Anti-Sex League?
Oh, I think there was.
I think there was.
It's been a while since I've read it.
So that's what the Republicans essentially are about.
Right.
I mean, you'll get Republicans say, "Hey, man, I'm shagging my booty off." You know, okay, good, go for it.
And meanwhile, I'm going to talk about that South Carolina, the candidate in South Carolina.
Let's do this. Oh, that's smart. But let me take this break first. But one of the things I wanted to think: if you were opposed to abortion, and you were opposed to unwanted pregnancies, wouldn't you support the idea of free birth control for anybody that wanted it?
It's just a little pill.
Yeah.
It's just a little pill.
That would keep down unwanted pregnancies, and it would keep down the need for abortions. I had the wrong name for the one that Ron was giving us. I will look it up.
What?
This is Janet Jones, I thought she was like a rock star.
So he had the wrong name.
That's what it was. I was putting in Jeanette.
That's what he told us it was.
Okay.
I wrote it down.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll take a break.
I will talk about this crazy teabagger.
Martin Luther. Yeah, we never even talked about Martin Luther King holiday, but what this crazy teabagger.
How he
came
turned
up
in turned that day
into his
right-wing
deal
against women.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, this is our last segment, so get in on it. It's 248-544-WRIF.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
Did you know that millions of seniors are treated each year for fall-related injuries? If you or someone you love is elderly and living alone, get ready for a toll-free number that could save a life. LifeStation is a medical alert system that provides the security and peace of mind to live a fulfilling and independent life in the comfort of your own home. Call LifeStation now at 1-855-322-5013. For less than a dollar a day, LifeStation offers quick access to medical help at just the touch of a button, 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. And with LifeStation, there's no setup fee and no long-term contracts. You can cancel at any time. Call right now for more information at no obligation. 1-855-322-5013. Put emergency help at your fingertips while maintaining your independence. Call LifeStation at 1-855-322-5013. The call and information are free. 1-855-322-5013. That's 1-855-322-5013.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, so our final segment, so you can ring us up at 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
Saying ring us up is kind of English, isn't it?
That's okay.
But here's why I do it, because I'm looking at this English paper, the Daily Mail from England. And Ron was calling us a little earlier about this baby killer, and her name is, it is Jeanine. It is G-E-N-E-N-E Jones. She was convicted of murdering one little 15-month-old in 1984 with a lethal dose of muscle relaxant.
Oh, so it was one.
Yeah, well, no. They say that she's suspected of killing up to 46 more under her care. And she'll be released from prison after serving just one-third of her 99-year sentence because of an expired Texas law that grants mandatory release to inmates with good behavior.
Okay, so...
I don't know. It's all pretty sad. Who knows what to do? So she did it when she's 30. She's now 63. I don't know. It's hard to...
Hard to say.
Hard to say, indeed. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Yeah, a couple of things.
We were talking about... Abortion.
Abortion, yeah. And
Republicans trying to...
Oh, yeah, and Martin Luther King. Yeah, you had that story.
Okay, this one. Last Monday, of course, was Martin Luther King Day. And a candidate in South Carolina who hopes to defeat Senator Lindsey Graham in the Republican primary said he has a dream as well. So what he did was he said, today is Martin Luther King Day. I mean, I can't believe the nerve of this guy to even include this in a conversation about... Such an amazing man. He said at the South Carolina Tea Party Convention in Myrtle Beach, Martin Luther King did a lot to help us as we struggled with racial equality and justice.
Struggled with it, yeah.
Uh-huh. Friendship and kindness
struggled
between...
Struggled against it, actually, in South Carolina.
Friendship and kindness between the races, and we celebrate that achievement. Oh. But, you know how we always say that? We can tell when someone's going to say, but. What I want to say to you is today is I, too... Have a dream. So he is using this speech for his, he then denounced the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling and went on a whole rant about his dream that, you know, abortion.
You know, sometimes there used to be a funny thing that people used to say, hooray, the workers are starving. The revolution will be here soon.
Oh, because they're starving. They've got to do something.
Which, of course, is ridiculous. You would never hope that people suffered incredibly bad conditions. But I have this little perverse thought that at some point, because people can never see beyond the Republican and Democratic Party, that they said, oh, these Republicans are so terrible. They started these wars based on lies. That would be Iraq and Afghanistan, folks, in case you've forgotten. They've sunk the economy. Let's get a Democrat in. And then things haven't worked out that well. I mean, good responsibility still that hasn't worked well. It still lies with the Republican. But they'd say, oh, now, so in 2016, we'll get the Republicans back in. So, you know, we just keep going round and round. But I have this, like, perverse thought is, let's give the Republicans the Senate, the House, and the presidency and see what happens. But it would be so ugly.
It would be so ugly. Just but then again, you look at the way it is now, and the Democrats can't get anywhere.
Yeah.
But
can you imagine having the types that are in the House of Representatives in the Senate and somebody like that in the presidency,
in
like President Huckabee?
With what was Vice President Palin?
Yeah. I'd love it. What would it would be great for talk show hosts.
Sure would.
Like we used to say with Bush, that used to be our thing. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable. Yeah, and I'd start every program with, I don't know where to start.
But
remember
this
that?
Is unbelievable.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it might be an opening for socialism. Because this is interesting. Almost 50% of the population, I'm not remembering this from... the interview I did with the author of a book.
It's coming
called,
up at 1 a.m.
Yeah. Imagine living in a socialist USA, that something like 50% of people under 30 or something like that do not have a negative reaction to the word socialism.
What's your second interview? I heard the end of it today.
Yeah.
It was really, really good.
Yeah, it really was.
Whatever it was.
Oh, no. That's right. It was about Detroit. My pals. Tom Stevens and Frank Joyce.
Yeah.
Long time Tom.
I think I heard the other one, as a matter of fact. I think they had him flip-flopped over at the other station.
Oh, then you heard, can you imagine voting, or can you imagine living in a socialist USA.
Yeah, this guy is great. This is going to be really a great interview, and because I was on the air at 7 a.m. this morning, so I caught the tail end of your interview.
And, hey, my prediction, I say this on the recording, that I'm predicting that this book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, will be on the New York Times bestseller list.
Okay.
And if you can imagine where came from, where the phrase Imagine came from was from Tool.
Oh.
Or actually singing a John Lennon song.
John
Lennon,
name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul McCartney and Ringo performed at the Grammys.
Did they do that?
They did not do that. But Yoko and her son Sean were there. And she was jamming. She was jamming to the rap music.
Really? Well, you know, I
love Yoko. Yoko haters, whatever. I like her.
I'm always so astounded that Imagine is as popular as it is because of the lyrics that are so
really
incredibly. I mean, it's not like they're buried.
They're pretty rebellious.
Yeah. Neither they aren't in the Tool song. Nor, you would think maybe with a band like Tool, you wouldn't be able to hear the words, but they are very distinct. Mm-hmm. And certainly when it's just John Lennon and a piano.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's take another call, and I'll get you the words for that in just a second, although most of us remember. Here's Jack in Clawson. Jack, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, I'd just like to sound like a Republican and tell you what they would say about the people on unemployment.
Okay.
Well, they're lazy, and they need to get a job.
Sure. But
that's what they say. Is this what you, so you're just acting?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to make sure.
I'm about ready to get laid off myself, so.
Oh, no.
Maybe I'll go to Kroger's and clean up the parking lot of the carts or something for maybe $4 an hour after tax.
Yeah, which, you know what? Sadly, for you, those jobs are all taken, Jack.
Yeah, that's what.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's why.
Probably because I'm not a teenager anymore.
I don't know. No, when I could, the Kroger on 13 Mile and Woodward, that would be the one that you would go to, right?
No, probably in Farmington area.
Oh, okay. Because I'll go to that one once in a while. I go to the pharmacy there, and it's adults.
But wait a minute.
Right?
But wait. Here is the difference, though. That is a United Food and Commercial Workers Union.
Oh, so everyone?
I don't know
if
everyone is,
so.
But certainly good portions of it. A neighbor of mine is a UFCW worker, and they've taken every job. That's what unions did, is that they're not going to say, oh, that job's not important, or that job is unskilled. What they say is that people have a right for a decent living wage. So they don't have to worry about can they get their kids proper medical care or for themselves.
Right.
They don't got to scrimp on, drug payments and all of that.
Well, now there's the Affordable Care Act. Jack, I'm curious what line of work you're in.
I'm a prison guard, or I used to be.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we talk about the prison industrial complex all the time. There should be plenty of jobs.
No, it's actually decreasing, isn't it?
Yeah, they're privatizing and... You know, like I was making somewhere in almost like $25 an hour.
Wow.
And they want to bring in these people making like $14 an hour.
Sounds like the wave.
It's going to be unsafe, you know. It's not going to be good.
This isn't, what is this, the county?
Yep.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got, Al Crook's Loose Lips at the helm there. Oh, no, you're in Macomb County.
Right.
Yeah. Or are you? No, Clawson is in Oakland County, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well,
where you work? Yeah.
Yeah, Oakland County. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
OCJ.
Yeah.
The Brooks Patterson. You know, Mr. Know-it-all.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, he got his start in politics way back in the day as a lawyer for these Ku Klux Klanners who had bombed these buses to stop integrating the Pontiac schools.
And how do people stay on top when they have that kind of history? I mean, we should bring that up more often.
Yeah. Well, he has a base.
Well, he has a base, and then people think, oh, he's a fat cat, that he's untouchable. Right?
Yeah. Well, Jack, I wish I could say something better than good luck, but I guess that's all for now. But
well,
thank you for calling.
Keep in touch with us.
Sure. Thank you so much, boy.
And I do wish you, we do wish you best
of
luck.
I'm trying to think.
See, and no, people don't care about
every
Jack,
time I've been
know?
Fired, awful. I was ready to go.
Peter, I don't think you should joke about it in this day and age.
No, I know. But, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't. I was just reminiscing. But, yeah, times were better, and but other people aren't. I didn't have any kids to get clothing for and braces.
And you're pretty good with your money.
Yeah.
I mean,
but other people,
well,
it
I
is
should
just,
say your wife is good with your
just,
money.
I make it, she spends it.
Well, but what I'm saying is, you know, you guys have always been somewhat frugal. You're not crazy with your money, and I know darn well. Deep down, you're probably a multimillionaire.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good luck. I got the car of my dreams, right? A Ford Fusion.
It's fancier than mine.
Why? It's got a great sound system. That's why. Anyway, imagine, that's the book that's coming up. Not the book, but the author, one of the editors of it. A bunch of essays called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And the reason that Michael Stephen Smith, my guest, and the other people that edited it called it that, it was because of the John Lennon song. And if you think about it, right off the bat, imagine John's at the piano. I don't know if you've seen that video. He's playing this white grand piano. And he said, imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. So he sets it off right away that he's an atheist, obviously.
Yeah, well, to me, it does say that, but I think that people can look at it in a different way in that why are we fighting over all of this? You know, why are
we
fighting
wars? Well, he says
there's
no heaven, there's no hell. No, but then in the second verse, he says, imagine there's no countries. Completely anti-nationalist, right?
Yeah.
It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion, too.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that says it all.
Yeah.
That's what
imagine
that's
all the people living life in peace. Then he says he's a dreamer, but he's not the only one. Then, hey, imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. This is pure, this is beyond socialism. This is communism, but not state communism, not Stalinism, not North Korea
or
China.
So how did he get away with that?
I don't know.
You know, I think it's because he was just so loved. He's a Beatle. I mean, he's a Beatle, right? Let's start with that.
But you would think that
he was all about peace and love.
I know, but you would think the idea would be that this would be so offensive to you know, to people.
Yeah, well, you know, oftentimes people
you know
just
what?
Like to sing along. They're passive music listeners. They're not really, you know, I mean, it's got a nice tune.
You're putting a worse spin on it than I am. I'm saying that people are down with the lyrics.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't mean to not give people credit. But a lot of music listeners are passive. I, for example... I'm a musician. I'm a singer-songwriter, but I don't really listen to lyrics. I listen to the sound of a song. I listen to the beat of the song. I listen to the feel of the song. I don't remember lyrics ever.
You know, I don't at all. The only
and I sang this song on stage for a while.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't know the lyrics by memory?
I kind of have them down a little bit better these days.
I am amazed, but we bring this guy up so much. Our mutual friend, David Rovics. You can go to David Rovics, ROVICS.com, DavidRovics.com. He has written hundreds of songs, and he knows the lyrics to them, and a lot of them are storytelling.
No, he doesn't.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Now, I'm sorry. Now,
now
he's got
the
little tablet or an iPad.
Now I love you, David, but he's gotten lazy. Now he can't do it without that.
Let me put it this way.
But when you have hundreds of songs, how can you remember all of those?
He used to before.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so he knew the.
He did.
Anyway. But the last stanza of Imagine is, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. I mean, this must send tea baggers, right-wing conservatives
over the edge.
Over the edge, because this is New World Order, commie, I don't know what. Remember, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and go down in the right-hand column, and there's a photograph of me sitting on a bench with a life-size statue of John Lennon, which is in Havana, Cuba.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that picture.
There's a John Lennon, me too. There's a John Lennon park, and on the, in the cement right below him, in Spanish, are the those words. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
So that says a lot right there,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, well, it might say a lot to people. Look, here is this authoritarian police state,
yeah.
Cuba, endorsing the words. And here, I mean, this is maybe, this is a long discussion. One that
maybe
actually,
this was a statement against the U.S. or
well, they, well, in the 1960s, from about 1962 to at least the late 60s, Beatles music was not allowed in Cuba. It was called bourgeois decadence.
Really?
Which what do you think that meant for the underground music scene there? They were, you know.
Well, what was that called? What was that movie about the Havana music scene?
You mean the name of the band? All of a sudden I'm forgetting. Yeah. I'll think of it in a second.
I'm giving you a new pen. You are no longer allowed to have a pen that clicks.
Oh, am I clicking the pen? Yeah. One of the cities in Cuba that I visited was a city, Holguin, H-O-L-G-U-I-N.
Okay.
And they had a cavern club. Remember, that's where the Beatles originally played? So, and they have these Cuban Beatle look-alike sound-alikes in it.
But Cuba? I love that.
So that's the question that confronts a lot of people. Can you have a socialized economy and political democracy? Or does it wind up like Stalin and Mao and Kim and all those other folks?
Right.
My guest at 1 o'clock, coming right up in about 10 minutes, Michael Stephen Smith, says that not only can you have socialism that is democratic, that democracy can only be realized with socialism.
Interesting. I look forward to hearing the first part of it, because I heard the last part of it.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I thought we had a caller, but we don't. But we can talk about a little about Detroit. Have you seen some of the? This is so bizarre. Like Governor Snyder said that he wants to repopulate Detroit with 50,000 immigrants.
Where is he?
I don't know.
Where are these immigrants coming from?
I don't know, but
because
he wants.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that what he sees, they'd be granted these visas in the first year to live and work in Detroit under this federal program, and they would be, we'd look for experts in fields like engineering, technology, and healthcare. But, you know, you just can't bring them here out of nowhere. They got to have some purpose in why they're here.
And method of getting here and housing, the jobs that you're speaking of.
Reverend Charles William II of the civil rights group National Action Network said he believed Detroit, as well as other Midwestern states, should be pro-immigration. However, he said, I will say on the other end of this, I think it's a little ambitious for Governor Snyder to put together a plan to induce more population when we still have to work on double-digit unemployment and high poverty that's already in our city.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. So,
it's really a good point. I tell you, the nerd just gets stranger all the time.
Yeah,
does he not?
Yeah, he does. Remember there was that report, this is our Detroit section here, that they said there were 50,000 stray dogs in Detroit?
Oh, yeah, and we were both astounded. We thought that certainly that cannot be true.
I mean, you would see dogs
everywhere.
Everywhere, all the time.
And
huge packs of dogs. There's a pack of 400.
When we go to concerts downtown or a sporting event or something like that. Well, good news, even though it's not the greatest news, but those numbers are false.
Yeah, apparently there's fewer than 3,000 stray dogs, which seems to be a lot. Roam the streets on any given day in Detroit. But the World Animal Awareness Society said its findings, they did this three-year study, debunked the image of tens of thousands of stray dogs.
Well, that's good. I mean, it made me feel a little bit better. And we do have a lot of great organizations, Detroit Dog Rescue and Mid-Michigan Animal Rescue. A lot of them, yeah.
They said the survey did not track stray cats, and he said there easily could be 10 to 20 times more cats outside on any given day than dogs. That means like 30 to 60,000 cats?
That can't be true.
I don't think that's true either. But, you know, these 33,000 dogs, there's less than 10 packs of three or more dogs that could be considered wild. And he said,
makes me so sad.
He said the true number of loose dogs will likely be under 1,000 on any given day. And those are often people that...
Still a lot.
Well, some people still, old school people, just let their dogs out.
Oh, I know.
That used to be the deal. Ask your dad. I mean, my dad was telling me they just, they would just let the dogs out.
Yeah.
And in fact, there is a song that was a 50s hit and was redone by Bad Company called... Youngblood? Mm-hmm. No.
Mean, who left the dogs?
No. Is it Youngblood or something? But one line is, bring in the dog and put out the cat. Oh, it's Yakety Yak. That's what
Don't talk back.
Yeah.
Okay, I know that one.
So that was the deal. So at one point when my wife and I were talking about how much to leash our first dog, and my wife said to my dad, you had a lot of dogs. Did you used to let them out without a leash? Yeah. We'd open the front door and let them out. Anything okay? He said, well, a couple of them got killed by cars.
Oh, God. Well, that was a long time ago.
It was.
Your dad lived a very long life.
Yeah. I mean, they were pretty...
Can you imagine your little fluff ball of
a
dog?
Who knew?
You have now?
Who knew I was going to wind up with a...
A little foo-foo?
Yeah.
I know, and I end up with a big, scary-looking dog.
You know, I don't know. This isn't sad. You know, this dog is so small and often gets so frightened that we used to have this really tough terrier, right, over 40 pounds.
Yeah.
And that dog was a real companion.
Yeah.
And this little one now, I think of it as...
It's kind of a baby.
We got to take care of it.
It's your little baby.
We got to protect it.
I love your dog, but she's kind of weird. Once you can get her to sit next to you, she's fabulous.
She's on a harness because you can't put, this is not one of those 3-pound dogs, folks. This is a 7-pound dog.
Oh, God.
And she has a harness, and so the tab that connects to the leash is right above her shoulders. And a couple of times, big dogs have come at her, and I can just pick her up like a yo-yo into my arms.
That's what you do when there's rain puddles.
Yeah, or there's puddles. Yeah, I just lift her over the puddles.
My dog, I think, weighs more than me, so I have no control. I have one of those pinch collars. It's the only way I can walk her.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Well, one of the things, when your dog, you're not supposed to let your dogs pull because they say they're trying to take over control of the pack.
Right. You need to have them right by your side on a tight leash.
And I said, what do I care if some 7-pound dog is trying to take over the pack?
I know, like it's anything's going to happen.
Yeah, right. All right. Hey, Jefferson, thanks for doing it all. Appreciate
it. Jefferson.
Had a lot of fun tonight. Thanks, folks. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for listening. And coming up next, hey, imagine a socialist USA.
Lynn Kuhn at 2 o'clock. We'll be back next week. Don't be too drunk after the big game. Thanks.
Right,
or do and don't call.
Yeah.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ow.
Dude, what is this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
That rocks on your smartphone. Download the 101 WRIF app for your iPhone or Android today. Brought to you in part by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Download from the App Store or Google Play Store now, or click the link at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The 2014 Riff Rock Girls Search is on. Ladies, get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. What if I said, imagine living in a socialist USA? Well, there's probably some of you say, we already live there. I mean, there's this famous guitarist just made some insane statements about the president and how he was a communist, not even, you know, way beyond a socialist. He was a communist and all that. But most people realize that this is a society that's dominated by big capital, big industrialists, big financiers, you know, big pharma, all of that. You know, it's the elites, the ruling class. You know, socialism is not on existing in this country, nor is it even on the agenda. But imagine living in a socialist USA. Actually, that is the name of a book that has just come out, and it's an amazing collection of essays about visioning what a socialist America would look like. And believe it, it's not about you know, the KGB or anything like that. This is about an extension of democracy. It's edited by Francis Golden, Debbie Smith, and Michael Stephen Smith. My guest is Michael Stephen Smith, and some of you may remember him from the last interview I did about a book he wrote with Michael Ratner. The book was Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder, about how the CIA executed Che Guevara. And Michael Stephen Smith is a New York attorney and an author. He's also the co-host of a show, Law and Disorder. You can go to lawanddisorder.org. It's on WBAI in New York, and it's on a number of stations around the country. And he's co-host with Michael Ratner again and Heidi Boghossian, who I also interviewed just recently. She is executive secretary of the National Lawyers Guild. Michael Stephen Smith, he lives with his wife, Debbie, and his talking parrot, Charlie Parker. Michael, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Real nice to be back with you. How are you?
I'm good. And I should say a dear friend as well.
For over 40 years.
That's right. Hey, so imagine living in a socialist USA. Let's clear it away. I mean, what about these people that say this country is already too socialist?
You know, that's just a lot of fog. Let me tell you about where this book comes from, and let's talk about why this country is not a socialist country, but what it could be like if it was.
Sure.
You know, I did this book. It wasn't my idea. It was Frances Golden's idea. And she came to Debbie and I. Debbie's my comrade and wife. And she said, before I die, she's 88 years old now. This is 2 years ago. I want to do two things. I want to get Mumia out of prison.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, right. Yeah.
He's a great journalist, like Frederick Douglass, a real genius, framed up on a murder charge. He's been in prison for over 30 years. Frances visits him. She's his friend, and she's his literary agent. She's quite a well-known literary agent here in New York. And she said, the first thing I want to do is get Mumia out of prison, and I want to do a book on what this country would look like if we got rid of capitalism. And she came up with the title, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and she asked me and Debbie if we would help her do it. And we did. That was a year and a half ago, and it's coming out January 22nd as the publication date. So far it's been received extremely well. We're having a book party, and C-SPAN is going to film the book party. So we are astounded. So you asked me, well, why is that? Socialism is no longer a dirty word, really, is it?
No. But you know what? One thing, Michael, that struck me, this 2012 National Pew poll that showed that almost 50% of people under 29 had a favorable reaction to the word socialism. That's quite incredible, because that was always used with the right wing, by the right wing, to stop even the most tepid reforms, whether it was health care or civil rights or anything.
Well, that's because people know what's going on and they don't like it. And they know that socialism is the opposite of what's going on. Merriam-Webster, you know, the dictionary, they got an online dictionary. The two words that got the most hits last year were socialism and capitalism.
Really?
That young woman that ran for city council in Seattle, Kwame Savant.
Sure.
She ran against an entrenched Democrat. She got over 100,000 votes, had huge community and union support, and people liked her, and they liked what she had to say about minimum wage and about education for young people and about the quality of life that people are trying to aspire to in Seattle and can't because of all the unemployment, about Boeing taking its aircrafts out of town. I mean, we're getting a hearing now like we've never had in my experience. There was a huge wave of socialism, of course, 100 years ago in this country. Mayor of Milwaukee, where I grew up, was a socialist, in fact. But the word had been dormant. It was a dirty word during the McCarthy era. But we're making a comeback, and I think this book is going to contribute to the conversation. So Francis said, let's do the book. And let's get a big publisher, mainline publisher, to put it out. And I thought, no chance of
that.
That's
what I would think. I'm astounded.
Yeah, well, as you know, Harper put it out. But we didn't go to Harper. First, we went to Oxford. And the head of Oxford was reputed to be a leftist. Francis went to him, and he said, no, he said, I don't want to do it. It's not balanced enough. And Francis is tough, said, balanced? What the hell are you talking about, balanced? What do you want to do, have me do half a book on fascism? So we went then to Harper, and Harper said, well, I don't think we want to do it. Our market will say we could only sell 8,000 copies. And I'm thinking, you know, 8,000 copies for kind of books I write, 8,000 copies is a lot.
Sure.
But Frances was persistent. She went back and she said to Harper, she said, look, I've given you the books by Barbara Kingsolver, the great best-selling author. She said, I gave you the book Goodnight Moon, you know, that children's book that sold more books than any other book in the United States except the Bible.
Wow.
She said, and I'm passionate about this, and I want you to do it. So they called her back, and they said, Francis, you've won out. We'll do it. And we'd like to see you and Debbie and Michael up at our office, and let's talk about the contract. So Francis and Debbie and I go up to the office, and we go up to the corner office of the executive vice president of HarperCollins. And, you know, HarperCollins is owned by Rupert Murdoch.
Sure, I was going to get to that, but yeah.
So we walk in, and it's one of those offices. I'm sure you've been in people's offices like this where it's got not just a desk and a couple of chairs in front of it, but it's got a table with chairs around it. It's got a couch with pillows on it, you know, corner windows near Fifth Avenue and 53rd Street. And I walk in, I look around, and on the couch I see two pillows. One pillow has a drawing of Queen Elizabeth II on it. The executive VP of HarperCollins is a British guy. And there's Queen Elizabeth on the pillow. And then I look over to the other corner, and there's another pillow, and that pillow has a drawing of Karl Marx on it.
Oh, my God. In HarperCollins. This is the worst nightmare of every conservative.
Yeah. So I smiled, and I said to Mr. Bingham, this is an auspicious beginning.
Yes.
And he laughs and says, yes. And then he says to me, and what do you define socialism as? And I said, well, in a word, it's a political and economic democracy. And he said, will you take $10,000 as an advance?
No.
And I said, yes. And I said, we're going to give all the profits we make from this book to the Mumia Abu-Jamal defense. Hmm. And we signed the contract.
Well, let me remind people that we are talking about the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. It's a series of essays that give a critique of what's happening now, but also a vision of what could be. It's edited by Francis Golden, Debbie Smith, and Michael Stephen Smith. Michael Smith is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. I still think that to a lot of people, you say socialism and you mention Karl Marx, people think Stalin, Mao, the suppression of individual rights, the worst thing imaginable, government overshadowing everything in our lives. Maybe capitalism's bad, but socialism has a bad history, they'd say.
Well, that's not what we got in mind. The socialism that existed in the Soviet Union, for example, was they attempted to build it on a devastated country after World War One. You can't. This country is the richest country the world's ever seen. This is more of a place where you could actually do a democratically organized economy, not a place that's been devastated by war where you have such poverty that you actually have cannibalism. You know, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about building a society on abundance, and that we can do here. You know, capitalism hasn't really lived up to It says it's the only system compatible with democracy. But look at what's happened lately. The NSA can listen in on any phone call anybody makes in the country. They record every keystroke you make on your computer. Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, asked the NSA, said, "Are you spying on Congress?" And they refused to answer him. And Jimmy Carter, after all these revelations, after Snowden, Jimmy Carter said, "We're no longer living in a democracy." So the claim that they make that capitalism is compatible with democracy is just false. So what about the claim that, well, capitalism is the only system that provides a better way of life for people? That's just not true. Real wages haven't gone up in 40 years here. The minimum wage, which a lot of people make, $7.50 an hour, you can't even live on it. What about inequality? They say, well, capitalism is supposed to bring people up. Well, this is the most unequal society, advanced country in the world. You got the Walton family, you know, that own Walmart. The five kids and the sister-in-law of Sam
Walton
are worth more. These six people, they're worth more than the bottom 30% of the population in the United States.
Well, hey, they earned. Oh, no, they didn't. That's right. They just inherited
$69.8 billion. And half the population doesn't have more than a few bucks. Half the population. And this family of six has got $69.8 billion. So it's not democratic. It doesn't offer any promise. And it's not egalitarian. Our book envisions a totally different kind of society. It wants people to imagine that. Because when you start imagining how things could be different, then you start moving to make it different. You got to have hope, as my friend Ramsey Clark says, because if you don't have hope, you don't do anything.
And a vision, which imagine living in a socialist USA does. Michael Stephen Smith, co-editor of the book, is my guest. And reading through this, I mean, I think this is a terrific book. And here's my prediction: the book is just about to be released, and I'm betting it's going to be on the New York Times bestseller list. But we'll see. People can call me back in 6 months and say either you were right or you were wrong. But this probably hit hit the right note at the right time. But Michael Smith, tell me this. What you said, and what often is in here, this first beginning with a catalog of everything that's wrong with this society, which is extensive and absolutely correct, most of it sounds like a reform of capitalism. And, in fact, if you think about the things you said, we ought to be able to pay people more, stop the inequality, not have these great inequalities of wealth and all of that. So why couldn't this book just be called Imagined Living in a Reformed Capitalism?
Because I don't think you can reform it. We can make demands, we can mobilize, we can try to win some of these demands, and we are. The Immokalee workers, for example, just won a lot for farmers. We can win some of these demands, but basically, if we want a society, I'll read you what Paul LeBlanc wrote in his chapter called The Third American Revolution. He says, socialism, he writes, involves people taking control of their own lives, shaping their own futures, and together controlling the resources that make such freedoms possible. Socialism will come to nothing if it is not a movement of the great majority, the interests of the great majority. People can only become truly free through their own efforts. And the capitalists aren't going to abide by that. This is a system that has to be totally transformed. They're not going to give up their power willingly. They sit at the heights of the economy. They're greatly privileged, and they're not going to budge. We have in this book, it's a three-part book. The first part is an essay on what's wrong with capitalism. And that's, you know, pretty obvious to people who just get out of bed and open their eyes in the morning. And that was the easy part. The difficult part of the book was the second part, the main part of the book, which is 21 essays on imagining what every aspect of life in America would be like if we didn't have capitalism. I'll give you some examples.
Sure, please.
Rick Wolf wrote about how you can democratically organize a capitalist factory. Mumia Abu-Jamal and Angela Davis wrote about alternatives to the criminal justice system. Michael Moore wrote a program of how you get from here to where we want to be and the kind of demands we should make. And I'd like to talk about that in a moment, but I want to just mention that we have a last part of a book that explains how to get from where we are to where we want to be, how to get from here to there. Leslie Kagan wrote on what queer life might be like in a different society. Juan Gonzalez wrote on immigrant workers. Kazembe Balogun on socialism and the black freedom struggle. Bill Ayers on teaching freedom. Dave Lindorf on socialized medicine. Tom Angotti on the right to housing. Arun Gupta on creating a sustainable food system. I did the one on what socialist law would be like. And my friend Michael Ratner, the head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, did one on what he would do if he was the Attorney General. That's a funny one. He says it'll be a cold day in hell if a person with my politics was appointed Attorney General. But he's talking about the future, and you know, it's possible that somebody like him could be the Attorney General.
Well, Michael Smith, let me just pose this to you. I was thinking about so much of the work that I do. Like you mentioned, the Walton family and the billions they have, more than tens of millions of other people, and there is so much inequality. All the unemployment, the people working for just horrible wages. There's a lot of people that are in the middle class. Forget about the upper 10%, but the people that are in the, say, the 50th and 60th and 70th percentile of income, they'd say, well, you know, I got a good job, I've got health care, you know, I get to go travel and all that. What's in it for me? You're talking about a system that would help oppressed people. And this is not me speaking, folks, but someone else saying, you know, it's too bad. You know, I'm okay. Well, you know, why would I want socialism? I'm doing fine under capitalism.
Well, we're not looking to change those people's way of life. You know, they've done well, and bless them. You know, let them continue to do well. But if you step back at it and you see what direction this place is going in, you got to worry, particularly about the ecological situation.
Sure.
And unless that problem is solved, all the other problems are secondary. And we're all on this planet together, whether you're in the middle class or the working class or the upper class. And without a democratically planned economy that gets rid of this cancerous growth, capitalism has to expand. It can't stay still. And in its expansion, it's ruining the ecology. We have, you know, one of the great ecological thinkers, Joel Covell, wrote a chapter, and it's really the main concern should be of all of us. And I wanted to just read you a little bit about what Joel wrote.
Please.
We don't solve this problem, we're in a lot of trouble. We're not going to solve the rest of them either. What were we going to say, Peter?
Well, I was just going to say that the name of his essay is "The Future Will Be Eco-Socialist," because without eco-socialism, there'll be no future. And Michael Smith, I agree with you completely that the productive and consumption patterns of capitalism have to keep increasing. And when we start thinking, and look at China. I mean, that expanded to the entire world. We're gone. I mean, the planet can't sustain increased production.
Over there, you can't even breathe.
Right, right. But go ahead. You were going to read from Joel Covell.
Well, so Joel,
who was great.
Joel writes, Karl Marx saw the system as berserk and fundamentally uncontrollable. As he vividly wrote in Capital, quote, accumulate, accumulate. That is the Moses and the prophets. In other words, capital is in the grip of a quasi-religious impulse that drives its system to convert the entire earth, its oceans and atmosphere and everything under the sun, into commodities to be sold on the market, the profits converted to capital. This leads to the obvious yet profound explanation of the ecological crisis and why it is life-threatening. The earth we live in is finite, and its ecosystems have evolved to accommodate to that finitude. Therefore, a system built on endless growth is going to destroy the integrity of the ecosystems upon which life depends for food, energy, and other resources. It is also going to destroy the human ecosystems or societies that have emerged from nature to inhabit the planet. That this brutally clear truth is not widely accepted is partly the result of how hard it is to face up to so harsh a reality, but it is chiefly the result of the titanic effort waged by capitalist ideology to deny its responsibility for the ruin of planet Earth.
Wow, that's eloquent, and I would say 100% accurate. My guest is Michael Stephen Smith. He, along with Francis Golden, Debbie Smith, have edited Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, extraordinarily surprising, published by Harper. And I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, to the book. In fact, I think there's one there already, but I will have one for sure. Now, as I said at the beginning, there are some people that are frantic that Barack Obama is the socialist, even a communist, and his policies are, you know, the sort of the subterranean Kenyan communist Muslim, you know, these are insane people. But, Michael Smith, you had a run-in with one of those folks, a fairly famous syndicated talk show host, a guy that goes under the name of Mancow. Give us a little description.
Well, when
of
my
that.
Publicist at Harper's asked me to be on the guy's show, it's called The Mancow Experience.
Yeah.
I laughed. I said, what is this, some kind of experiment in cross-species sex?
Right.
And he said, oh, no. He said, the guy's on Fox News, and he wants to interview you about the book, and it'd probably be a pretty good experience. Why don't you try it? So, you know, I was a little hesitant. To my mind, Fox News means rich people paying rich people to tell middle-class people to blame poor people.
Right, there you go.
But I reluctantly went on, and I'm sitting out in the living room, and I got this talking bird, Charlie Parker, as you mentioned. So I start talking to the guy, and the bird starts talking and chirping. And the guy gets irritated. He says, well, what about... we got socialism in this country already, he says. And the bird starts talking some more, and then he says to me, I'm trying to answer him. I said, you know, we're talking about an economic democracy as well as a political democracy. And I try to explain that we need a third American revolution. The first one, we got England off of our necks. And the second one, black people at least got formal citizenship. But the third one is going to bring about an economic democracy. And he goes berserk and starts yelling, we've got socialism here already. Look at the people in Detroit. They got free education. They got free food. They got free cable TV. All they do is sit around and eat Twinkies. So I figure this guy is a raving racist. And I tell him, I'm not going to be on your show anymore. I'm going to hang up the phone. Goodbye. And I hang up on him.
Wait, you missed one thing, what he threatened. He said what he said.
Oh,
he wanted...
said, yeah, he told me that he was going to punch me out. And then he said, I'm going to punch out your bird.
By the way, folks, I've been a guest at Michael and Debbie Smith's house, and this is a talking bird, let me tell you. But, hey, we better finish up the story because we're almost running out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah, so let me tell you what happens after this. So, you know, after he tells me he's going to punch out my bird, and then he goes on this racist diatribe against my people in Detroit, I thought, I got nothing to do with this guy, and I hang up on him. He calls me back. I'm not exaggerating, Peter. The guy called me back at least 20 times. I recorded some of the conversations. He kept calling me and calling me, harassing me, and I kept saying, I don't want to talk to you. And then after a while, I'd answer the phone, and I would say, imagine living in a socialist USA. And I kept saying that. And finally, he stops. And then that night at 1:45 in the morning, I'm sound asleep. The guy calls me up.
This is Mancow, folks, a nationally syndicated talk show host who is such a whack job. But go ahead.
A real whack job. And this guy must make a lot of money.
He does.
He has something better to do than, you know, harass some guy in New York at 1:35 in the morning. Calls me up. And you can imagine what I told him.
Sure. Don't say it.
And then 4:30 in the morning, he calls me up again.
Wow.
And then he calls me up again the next day at 10:30 in the morning. So
I called up
Harper's, and I said, I want the head of Harper's in New York to call up this guy's boss. And I want this guy to understand that if I ever hear from him again, I hired a civil rights law firm, People's Law Office in Chicago, where this guy is from. And if I hear from him again the next day, I'm going to be in federal court with this guy, and I'm going to hold a press conference. That's what's going to happen.
Well, good. Michael, let's do this. We are almost out of time. And on some of these interviews, I play over again, and I think this is one I certainly will. And if we give very specific dates, that kind of eliminates it. There is going to be a book party for Michael Smith and Debbie Smith and Francis Golden's book, Imagine Living in the Socialist USA. I'll have that on my website.
Yeah, that's January.
I was going to say, we don't want to give the date. That's...
No, we don't.
Because then people will, what if I play it again in July, you know?
Well, you know, we're coming out to Detroit. We're going to have a book party in Detroit.
And I'm going to have that on my website, but we are not going to put it on this broadcast.
Okay.
All right. We are out of time, and so we should wrap this up real quickly. The book is Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. If all you're doing is reacting either way, positively or negatively, to the word socialist, this is the book to read. This is the book to confront. This is the book to challenge whatever views you had from either side of the question. So, Michael, I want to thank you so much for being on.
Will you give me a last word?
Last word.
We have in this book a second Bill of Rights. The first one is for political freedom, religious freedom. The second one is for, and Michael Moore wrote this, he based it on an idea of President Roosevelt, and he says that every American has a human right to employment, health care, full and free education, to breathe clean air, drink clean water, eat safe food, and to be cared for with dignity and respect in their old age. That's what we're trying to build here, and that's going to take a socialist transformation.
Absolutely. So imagine. Thank you very much, Michael
Peter,
Stephen
good to be
Smith.
On your show.
All right.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Hurry to Verizon for the trade-in and trade-up smartphone sale. For a limited time, trade in your smartphone and get a $100, $200, or even $300 gift card towards a new smartphone depending on the value of your trade-in. All on America's largest and most reliable 4G LTE network. Trading up to the reliable network you deserve. That's powerful. Verizon. Click the banner to shop now. Requires new 2-year activation. Trade-in must be in good working condition. Gift card takes up to 2 weeks from receipt of trade-in.
Whether it's a serious fall, fire danger, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company with its slogan, "Help, I've fallen and I can't get up," protects its members. Here are some of them.
When you have a heart attack like I did and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Now, Life Alert can also protect you in a fire emergency with a system that automatically notifies our monitoring center.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can avoid or delay going into a nursing facility. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now. 1-800-404-2454. That's 1-800-404-2454. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure at 1-800-404-2454.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You may remember over the last few months, I've had a couple of guests on, separately and together, and we've talked about Detroit. It's extraordinarily complex what is going on in Detroit, and on the other hand, it's relatively simple. Tom Stevens, who's joined us, works with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, and I cranked out a number of Tom's recent emails, and I don't know. There's a lot here. Tom Stevens, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Happy New Year, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we can still say it to January 31st. And joining him, his partner in thought crime, Frank Joyce, longtime Detroit journalist and activist. He was a former public relations director of the UAW. And full disclosure, both of them are good friends of mine. So thanks, guys. Welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Tom.
What about what I just said? That on one hand, what's happening in Detroit with the bankruptcy and everything that's going on? On one hand, it is so complex, it almost gives me a headache trying to figure out what's going on. On the other hand, it's relatively simple in its basic definitions. What do you guys?
Well, I'll go first.
Somebody should.
I'm not shy.
Yeah.
Yes, the moving parts are complex. You know, it's kind of like a watch. A watch has complicated inner workings. But you just look at the thing and it tells you what time it is. And Grace Boggs, you know, likes to pose the question, what time is it on the clock of the world? And I think it's appropriate to talk about what time is it on the clock of Detroit. And what most people are led to believe is that what time it is on the clock of Detroit is like the apocalypse. It's the end times. It's, you know, it's catastrophe and collapse. And that is a component and a reality of it. But it is also a time of people starting over, of people taking of what I call the help is not on the way economy. So it is a polarity. It is evidence, a very advanced reality of the collapse of an old system, but it also has the seeds of the beginnings of a new one.
Tom Stevens, what do you think?
Yeah, it sounds like what you might call Jones Day Detroit versus DIY Detroit or do-it-yourself, right?
Yep, there you go.
Now, that may have some complexities in it for everyone, and I think we have to really give explanations. Jones Day, what does he play, second base or is it third base?
Who's on first, right?
Let's
recap. I mean, I've been on your show talking about this twice. The first time was last spring, and we had just heard about Jones Day in relation to Detroit at that time. It's the largest law firm in the country. One of their partners is Kevin Oren. He's the emergency manager, so he's the local government now. And we talked about their conflicts of interest, the fact that they represent banks that are major creditors of the city, for example, as well as others. The next time that Frank and I were on the show, I believe it was last fall, we talked about the regional racism of the area and how the region has shaped Detroit. And here we are in the depths of the winter. It's, what, 12 degrees outside or whatever. And these two narratives have just collided in real time like a epic train wreck. And things are not looking too good for our friends from Jones Day. I mean, I'm specifically talking about January 16th, 2014, when to the shock of banksters all over the world, Judge Stephen Rhodes refused to allow them for the second time to borrow money on behalf of Detroit and create a new secured debt and pay their other clients, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and UBS, two big banks, the second time they tried, $169.2 million.
So Judge Rhodes is a good guy here?
I think Judge Rhodes made the correct decision in this case, and I would add the following. He made it in part not just because he's a good guy, but because of people like Tom and a lot of others who in Detroit are resisting emergency management, and some formerly allied with that group, and a lot of other people who have been resisting this whole destruction of democracy in Detroit for a long time and have been putting out information and perspective that sometimes we feel like nobody's hearing it, but then along comes a judge and takes essentially a position that is correct and valid, which was this was never a legal deal in the first place with these banks, and it was made under very sleazy and conditions of extreme duress. But to me, the most significant thing about Rhodes' ruling is to put it in the perspective of how come, after all these months, except for those resisting the whole process of the takeover of Detroit by banks and corrupt politicians, no other mainstream media, not the Detroit News, not the Detroit Free Press, how come Judge Rhodes could understand this argument and nobody else could?
Well, let's do this, though. Let's go back to one of the fundamental questions that people may have. To be sure, I don't think there's great trust in the banks, or as Tom Stevens so eloquently puts it, the banksters, and certainly not in the political establishment. But I think most people would see, well, here was a city that couldn't manage its own affairs, that dug itself deeply in debt, that had corrupt politicians, and something had to be done. And what that was to bring some financial stability to it by appointing somebody that had, essentially dictatorial powers that preempted all the democratic forms, but it was necessary. You know, you had to, what's the old thing, break a few eggs to make an omelet. Oh, I think that was Stalin, though, so I don't know if we want to quote him. But that's sort of, as we call it, the basic narrative. I mean, things were broken in Detroit, and at least with all the problems, this was the attempt to fix it.
Well, I think that is the dominant storyline, right? And that leads us into the train wreck that has occurred on Jones Day's watch in the last 2 weeks. I mean, what I would urge your listeners to do in order to is listen to what you just said again, if they get a chance on the podcast or whatever, and go to the website of the U.S. District Court and the Bankruptcy Court. All of these arguments, in a great public service have been recorded in our podcast, just like the podcast of this show. If you go to the U.S. District Court, the bankruptcy court, there's a box up on top that says the Detroit bankruptcy, and you can click on the audio files, and you can listen to Judge Rhodes' decision from January 16th, and you can listen to the closing arguments on the Monday before that. What would that be? Thursday is the 16th, the 13th, or whatever. The closing arguments of, in particular, the Bank of America Merrill Lynch lawyer and the lawyer for Ambac Insurance Company who followed him. And Merrill Lynch Court, of course, wanted the money. And the guy said, Judge, it doesn't matter. You can find this is illegal, but you can't do anything about it. And you can hear the judge's reaction to that arrogance. And so, yeah, that's the popular corporate line that, as Frank has pointed out, and how can they never ask themselves, wait a minute, does this make sense? And what we're seeing is this unraveling in real time right now. And that's, we haven't even gotten to the regional racism part yet, which...
Well, we can do that, because I was going to say, so many shows do the good, the bad, and the ugly. I thought we would reverse it so we could end on a positive note, and that'd be the ugly, the bad, and the good. The ugly in the form of L. Brooks Patterson. At it again. Maybe, Frank, could you summarize sort of what came out of his New Yorker interview?
Well, I think the quote that is the most revealing, and I have put it on my phone so that I'll have access to it at all times and get it right, because I in a million years, you know, I've been writing about racism and been an anti-racist activist for a very long time, but I swear I never thought I'd hear Brooks Patterson, of all people, put it this openly. And what he said to the reporter in this New Yorker article is that what he had predicted and indeed advocated many years before had come to pass. And what he said is, what we're going to do is turn Detroit into an Indian reservation where we herd all the Indians into the city, build a fence around it, and then throw in the blankets and corn.
Yeah, I hope not diseased blankets.
Well, the fact of the matter is, that is what happened, and they did throw in a lot of diseased blankets, and among those diseased blankets was the credit swap default deal that now the people who want to collect money from that deal themselves would admit was a major factor in tipping Detroit over into bankruptcy in the first place. And, I mean, it's sad frustrating or annoying or whatever you want to call it. But what Brooks Patterson said, sometimes people use the metaphor of a noose around the neck of Detroit. But financial institutions and others have turned Detroit into a reservation, have taken political power steadily away from the residents of Detroit, and have imposed financial deals that are the true cause of the crisis of the Detroit government.
Frank Joyce, who just spoke then, is one of my guests. Frank's a longtime Detroit journalist and activist, former public relations director for the United Auto Workers. Tom Stevens is here as well. He's from Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. You can go to d-rem.org. And Tom Stevens, how seriously should we take L. Brooks Patterson? After all, the man got his start in politics. How? As an anti-integration racist activist in the suburbs. So it's not real surprising. It's like a guy that hasn't changed. Or is he just some old fool who we're all hoping will be the passing of the generations and guys like him will be gone?
Yeah, that's all he is. That's all he is. But what he's saying, and I think Frank, of course, closed in right on the key point. And by the way, did you notice that the editor of the Detroit News, Nolan Finley, in a column entitled In Defense of L. Brooks Patterson, said, oh yeah, that might be a little crude, but it's basically true.
Right.
What does this mean? Or he said it's not far off.
Well, what do they always say? Unpack that for us.
Right. I mean, isn't Brooks Patterson in his advanced years and having been recently almost killed in an auto accident and going through some kind of really bizarre and, it has to be said, incredibly stupid interview with a New Yorker reporter who told the truth, isn't he just giving voice to the policy of emergency management? Isn't this exactly what they're doing with the neighborhoods in Detroit? I mean, you know, and now to bring it up to date, you know, this is the train wreck that's happening in real time, right? Judge Rhodes has said to the lawyers, who are also the government of Detroit, stop trying to sell out this client to your other clients. Don't do it anymore. The next week, Brooksy gives voice to the, I won't say thinking because it's not thinking, the attitudes that underlie this racist colonial exercise and domination. And now we've got Governor Snyder suddenly trotted out after headlines all week talked about $350 million from the state to be thrown in to save the art of the DIA and to subsidize the cuts to the pension. I won't go into the details of it because the details aren't known, for one thing. But what Snyder finally says when he comes out is he says, oh, yeah, $350 million over 20 years. Huh. I mean, I thought maybe he was going to say as long as the grass grows and the rivers flow or something. You know, when you make promises in this context of domination, like the, as the Anishinaabe people of this peninsula found out, those promises are made and intended to be broken. And I think that's what we're facing now. And Governor Snyder is trying to throw in some money just so that these negotiations don't fall apart. And it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. If these guys have another week like the last 2 weeks, it's going to be an emperor's new clothes moment.
Well, Tom,
isn't already.
Tom Stevens and Frank Joyce, please answer this as well. I was going to bring that up about Governor Snyder, who suddenly seems like this generous guy offering hundreds of millions of dollars to save the pensions and save the arts. So I would have thought he would have made it into the good category. No?
Well, I want to go back for a second to Brooks Patterson, but I'll answer your direct question first. I mean, I think this is what Tom was trying to say, and let me just make it more explicit. This is the pattern of the relationship of government to the Native American peoples, which is littered with promises of in exchange for your going peacefully to your reservation and not bothering us anymore, we will give you X, whether X is a blanket, or whether X is a supply of corn, or whether X is the right to run a casino, or whatever.
A subprime mortgage?
Or a subprime mortgage. But the history is pretty clear that those, even those promises, as limited or as insidious as they may be, are not kept. What's more interesting in the context of Snyder's comments also is that over the last 30 years, the amount of revenue that was supposed to be, of state revenue that was supposed to be shared with the city of Detroit has been withheld and is a major factor in creating the financial crisis of the Detroit city government in the first place. And that, too, reproduces this dynamic of cowboys and Indians, if you will. I want to add on a couple points about Brooks Patterson, though, because as you said, Peter, his claim to fame, the way I'm betraying my age here, but I remember it fairly well when it happened. Brooks Patterson made his entry into politics by defending members of the Ku Klux Klan, who the night before school buses were supposed to be used to take black children into previously white schools in Pontiac, Michigan, burned the buses to the ground. And that's how Brooks Patterson appeared on the scene 40-odd years ago. Now we know that the views he held then are the same views that he holds today, but the point that the Nolan Finleys and lots of other pundits miss is he's not just the cranky old grandpa at the Christmas dinner table. He's the many times elected chief executive of Oakland County, which until recently was the single richest county in all of the United States. And the last time I checked is now, I believe, down to number 5 or number 6. And he is a person of considerable political power well beyond Oakland County within the Republican Party in the state of Michigan. So this idea that, oh, it's just Brooksy running off at the mouth. No, this is a guy that has had his hand on the levers of power in southeast Michigan for 40 years. This is not just your cranky grandpa at the Christmas dining table.
And the other unfortunate thing is, I'm sure his views are reflected, or the other way around. I mean, it's like two mirrors looking at one another in terms of the way many people view the situation in Detroit. The two of you, Frank Joyce, Tom Stevens, know the intricacies of what's happening in Detroit so well. From looking from the outside is what I said at the beginning. It just looks like those people couldn't handle their own affairs and needed the Cowboys to fix it. How do we begin to, and we're doing it here partly, but how do we begin on a larger scale to get people to look at all of this with some understanding?
Well, a good place to start is the New Yorker article in the January 27th issue, Drop Dead Detroit, because it's not just a bunch of crazy, stupid things that Brooks Patterson said. The author, Paige Williams, used what he said as, like you say, a mirror to held up to this region. You know, you never see yourself until you see yourself as others see you, and pointed out that, as she says, if suburbs are parasites that destroy that live off their host, their urban host, this one is destroying its host. And so now we're going from that narrative that you laid out, Peter, at the beginning of our discussion here, where it's just a bunch of local, corrupt, incompetent politicians, greedy unions, or whatever. Let's not talk about race, but they're thinking about race. Now we're seeing the regional economic dynamic, right? The fantastically unbalanced and unjust pattern of economic development that Brooks Patterson has been instrumental in his whole career in engineering, that he's been praised for before he shot off his mouth last week. And as part of it...
And it's still being praised for after he shot off his mouth.
That's true. And Frank alluded to, you know, the broken promises, and the one that happened here, he alluded to it, was that in the 1990s, Governor Engler, one of Brooks's old allies, made a deal with Detroit Mayor Archer to maintain a certain level of state revenue sharing, which was broken. And after the revenue sharing was reduced, and after the Wall Street-induced crash of 2008, that was one of the major factors that pushed the city over into the financial emergency that led to the emergency manager and that led to the bankruptcy now. And so as this thing plays out, we're starting to see it. The concern is that, you know, the role that our local corporate media play here is so, as Frank alluded to a little while ago, is so narrow-minded and blinkered, you know, that they were so shocked that these things were said by Brooks Patterson and practically rushed to his defense and actually covered up the thrust of the article. Because, like I say, it's right. Not just he said these stupid things. It's, oh, look what this says about the history and development of this region and what happened to the city of Detroit.
Well, Frank Joyce, Tom Stevens, we have about 6 minutes left, and we talked about the ugly, L. Brooks Patterson. I don't know if we got to the bad, but let's kind of skip to the good, and let's see where this goes. And that is, you know, there used to be, and you were talking about your memories going back, Frank, you may remember that there was a comic strip, Wonder Warthog. And the slogan was, why spend $250 billion on defense when you can get Wonder Warthog for half the price?
Yes.
So why do we need Wonder Warthog when we have our man who is buying up everything in Detroit and going to make things right, billionaire Dan Gilbert? Does he belong in the good category?
I don't think he belongs in the good category. I don't think he belongs in the bad category, frankly, in the way that I would put Brooks Patterson in that category.
He's in the ugly.
Yes. He's in the ugly category for sure. The fact of the matter is there is a lot of investment in Detroit. There is a lot of capital of various kinds pouring into Detroit. And I've made the point, maybe even here on this show before, that what that demonstrates is that at this stage of the evolution of capitalism, they don't really care that much about government one way or the other. Their control is so absolute that they can create whatever structures they need, whether it's getting the trash picked up or whether it's getting laws enforced and, you know, seeing to it that people are put in jail and so on and so forth. So this idea that the way I put this is that the government of Detroit is bankrupt, but Detroit is not. But within the moving parts of the Detroit economy is what I call the fourth economy. And, or as I said earlier, the help is not on the way economy. because Detroit is also the location of 1,200 urban farms that are becoming increasingly more sophisticated, not just in how we grow food, but how we distribute food and how we create a truly local economy. And there are fascinating projects going on in Detroit now with the community production of goods, with local production of electricity, with creating an economy that is much more self-reliant and that is going to operate whether Dan Gilbert or Brooks Patterson or whoever it is in a good mood today or not a good mood today, whether they want to throw some blankets over the fence or whether they don't want to throw some blankets over the fence. We'll make our own blankets. Thank you very much.
Tom Stevens, and actually, you guys can look at the clock, see how much time we got. We're going up to 25 there, so we got about 3 minutes left. You're reading a big book there about world capitalism. What Frank is describing in many ways is post-capitalist. Is that the future for, say, the poor of Detroit and maybe the classes just above that?
If you want a solution for Detroit, you have to look at different models. Capitalism did this to Detroit. The crisis of Detroit is a crisis of capitalism. The 700,000 people that are living within the limits of the city of Detroit, about half of them in poverty, even by the inadequate U.S. definition, have needs, and an economy that meets their needs as opposed to an economy that exploits them is possible, and people are already working on it. And then it brings in the suburbs and the state and the corporations, even in Dan Gilbert and everybody else,
well, you know, people like to talk trash about the people of Detroit, including Brooks Patterson and lots of people like that. And to your earlier point, Peter, you know, since the time of slavery itself, the owners of the plantation have been demonizing the slaves.
Sure.
Have been describing them in the same way that they describe Detroiters now as lazy and shiftless and corrupt and hopeless and unable to manage their own affairs. This is a very old story in American history. It's never been true. And I said this, I was in a debate with somebody just last night, that I stand in awe of the people of Detroit. If you want to go all Darwin with it, who are the fittest who are surviving here? Under extremely difficult conditions. That would be the people of Detroit.
You know, we have to do another show because I think we ought to get into the specifics of the good, but as you can see by the clock on the wall, figuratively speaking, we're out of time. A good place, Tom Stevens, I think you would agree, would be go to d-rem.org. That's Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. Tom Stevens, an attorney and Detroit activist, works with that organization. Frank Joyce, longtime Detroit journalist and activist, former public relations director of the UAW, and certainly where, I mean, Frank, you got to come up with some website, the Boggs Center probably.
Well, the Boggs Center, boggscenter.org is a good place to go. You can find stuff that I've written about Detroit at alternet.org, which I think does a pretty good job of covering Detroit issues and related issues.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program, and we needed an hour, but hey, we can do it again. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
Did you know that millions of seniors are treated each year for fall-related injuries? If you or someone you love is elderly and living alone, get ready for a toll-free number that could save a life. LifeStation is a medical alert system that provides the security and peace of mind to live a fulfilling and independent life in the comfort of your own home. Call LifeStation now at 1-855-322-5013. For less than a dollar a day, LifeStation offers quick access to medical help at just the touch of a button, 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. And with LifeStation, there's no setup fee and no long-term contracts. You can cancel at any time. Call right now for more information at no obligation. 1-855-322-5013. Put emergency help at your fingertips while maintaining your independence. Call LifeStation at 1-855-322-5013. The call and information are free. 1-855-322-5013. That's 1-855-322-5013.
Oh, my God.
Get all of Dave and Chuck the Freak's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. Brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. 101 WRIF.
Rock and roll.
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Riff.